This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Jim, do you have any idea what the Higgs boson particle is all about?
Nope.
Neither do I, but I know I'm interested in it, and I think it's got a lot more to do with the future of life than all this falderal around the Pope and the Catholic Church. So we're going to be talking about that. And speaking of the Catholic Church, I may be the only human being living in Boston at this time that actually has some sympathy for Cardinal Law. I think it was a mistake to run him out of town. I wish he were still here for a whole bunch of reasons, including I'd like some answers.
You're right, by the way. You are the only one, as far as I know. It's also the 50th anniversary of the case which guaranteed the right to a lawyer for low-income criminal defendants. Former Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court, Margie Marshall, will join us to tell us whether the commitment's being honored. Then two new TV phenomena, serial killers and binge viewing. The Globe's Matthew Gilbert and Sarah Rodman will tell us why. It's all next on Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama has chosen Assistant Attorney General Thomas Perez for Secretary of Labor. The 51-year-old is the son of immigrants from the Dominican Republic. If confirmed by the Senate, he would help spearhead several work initiatives for the administration that include an increase in the minimum wage.
Tom's fought to open pathways into the workforce for everyone willing to contribute, including people with disabilities, LGBT Americans, and immigrants.
But Perez is likely to face some Republican opposition. The Justice Department's Inspector General recently released a report that says Perez gave incomplete testimony to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He said the department's political leadership was not involved in the decision to fire three defendants in a lawsuit the Bush administration filed against the new Black Panther Party. The U.S. market's trading lower on news that Cyprus might approve a sizable levy on bank deposits in exchange for a national bailout. Lawmakers on the tiny island south of Turkey are considering a deposit tax of 6.75% on accounts of up to 100,000 euro, or $131,000, and 9.9% on higher amounts. The plan is raising fears of bank runs in the other 16 countries that use the euro, and Russian President Vladimir Putin is denouncing Cyprus's plan to avoid the financial meltdown. More on that from NPR's Corey Flintoff.
The financial crisis in Cyprus has frightening implications for Russia. Russian banks and corporations have more than $30 billion in Cypriot banks. Many Russians with money were attracted to the Mediterranean island by its lax banking regulations. At least some of those deposits are alleged to be illegal profits that were funneled to Cyprus and laundered through the banks there. A spokesman for President Putin quoted him as saying that the plan to impose a one-time tax on bank accounts would be unfair, unprofessional, and dangerous. Cypriot lawmakers have postponed a vote on the plan until tomorrow. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
Members of Syria's main opposition are gathered in Turkey to discuss forming a government to rival that of President Bashar al-Assad. It's described as the group's most serious effort yet to form an interim cabinet that could operate in rebel-controlled areas. 12 people, mostly exiles, are running to become interim prime minister of the Syrian rival government. The U.S. sought to reassure Poland not to read too much into Washington's decision to scrap the final stage of a European missile defense system in Poland. Last week, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the interceptors would be placed in Alaska instead because of the threat posed by North Korea. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was down 8 points at 14,506, NASDAQ off 5, and the S&P 500 down 4 points. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn with the local stories we're following. There's another storm heading our way with snowfall beginning after midnight tonight, so we could see accumulation of 2 to 4 inches by the start of tomorrow morning's commute. Alan Dunham of the National Weather Service says the drive-in won't be pretty.
The snow will continue into the morning hours, and then gradually during the commute, we'll see sleet and rain mix in, and then finally change to all rain by afternoon.
Dunham says we'll see more snow overnight Tuesday, which will add another couple of inches, coming to a total accumulation of 6 inches before the storm heads out. The number of people applying to be police officers in Boston has fallen dramatically in the past few years, prompting the department to launch an aggressive recruiting campaign. Experts tell the Boston Herald police work doesn't have the job security it once had, and police are under intense media scrutiny. New Hampshire lawmakers are considering joining most other New England states by decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of marijuana. But the proposal faces an uphill battle in both houses. A House vote is expected this week. The House will also vote on a proposal legalizing medical marijuana. New federal statistics show Rhode Island tied with California with a national worst 9.8% unemployment rate in January. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released data for all 50 states today. That was a drop of 0.1 percentage point for Rhode Island from December. The state's rate has been on a steady decline, and labor officials say the economy is moving in the right direction. Support for NPR comes from the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. In sports, the Celtics take on the Miami Heat tonight at the Garden. And as you heard, we have a winter weather advisory in effect from 9 p.m. this evening until 11 a.m. tomorrow. As for this afternoon, mostly sunny skies, cold with highs in the mid-30s. Tonight, snow mainly after midnight with accumulation of 2 to 4 inches. Windy with overnight lows in the lower 30s. At 12:06, it's 29 degrees in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio at 89.7 FM. I'm Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is in Rome, and while there, she actually may stop into the Pope's installation. It's true. Emily Rooney, who is not in Rome, is sitting in. Hi, Emily.
I was trying to take evacuation day off. That was really Marjorie's excuse. That's what she was doing.
Why were you not at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast?
I've never been to that.
Your absence
was noticeable.
It's the one day
I'm embarrassed to be Irish.
Really?
I feel like that continued all day long. I was in South Boston last night, don't ask, and I was in downtown this morning just running some errands, and it was the filth and the litter. It's like, what's wrong with people?
Do you want to hear some of what you missed? Let's listen to it anyway. Here is Congressman Lynch. Obviously, the two stars were Lynch and Markey. First, here's Congressman Lynch.
Either I will be the first ironworker elected to the United States Senate, or Ed Markey will be the first ice cream truck driver elected. So we'll either have a voice for working families, or we'll have a voice for Ben and Jerry's.
But I'm bummed. Thank you.
So funny.
I don't see her laughing, but This one will really get you. Here's Congressman Markey, the other Democrat seeking the nomination. Here he is.
He's got his long-form birth certificate saying that he was born with his work boots on in a manger that he welded together himself. That's salty.
Emily Rooney is bent over with light. It's amazing. That was good, right?
Jim, I can't believe you were there at 8 o'clock.
I was.
You had to stay until like 12:35.
I did.
Why am I television host of the
St. Patrick's Day
breakfast?
I understand.
That is painful. All right, so I heard you ask Governor Patrick this last week. Now I'm going to put it on you. Hmm. Would you rather be host next year?
Yes.
Or be waterboarded?
Waterboarded. Now, joining us to talk politics in Studio 3 are Charlie Chippio. He's from Chippio Strategies. Erin O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. Great to see you both.
Thrilled to be here.
Now, one of you was responsible enough to watch. Would you please raise your hand?
I think our listeners might know by my last name.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Erin O'Brien.
And Charlie, you obviously didn't care much about being here today. Didn't you watch,
My
please?
Decision has nothing to do with any disrespect for Emily or for Erin or for anybody else of Irish descent. You know, just watching the annual Tammany Clubhouse meeting is just more than I can bear.
Your favorite word, Tammany Clubhouse.
It's just more than I can. It's so excruciating. I got to draw the line. Not even for GBH can I watch that.
And so do they continue? I mean, every year somebody writes, there'll be a column in the Globe tomorrow or Emily tonight or somebody will say, RIP. I mean, it's the end of this thing. No more. No more Weldon. Well, Weld was there yesterday, which was odd. There was no Bulger to be paired with him.
Who hosted it?
Linehan. Yeah, who was the... Oh. And in all fairness, this was thrust on him a couple of weeks ago when Jack Hart decided to step down as the South Boston Senator. But is it time to call it quits and just remember the great moments?
Well, maybe stop televising it.
Thank you very much.
I know.
That's the wrong answer.
I didn't say that, by the way.
Not that the host was not fabulous.
How was I, by the way?
You were fantastic.
I was incredible.
No, but really, it's old school. Oftentimes, in more seriousness, we ask, why aren't there new faces in Massachusetts politics? Why is it the same old folks? And then we get this two-hour treatment of why it's an old boys network. And so
is that only 2 hours?
There's a certain tradition in it and things like that, but it is it's an exemplar of why it's hard to break into politics in Massachusetts if you're not in the club.
Why do you think Bill Weld made a return yesterday, Charlie Chippia? I mean, everybody was asking the question. He was not quite as great as he was because he wasn't paired with Bulger. I mean, that's hard to do with a solo act. But why is Bill Weld at this advanced stage of his career? Some are actually speculating that he's thinking of running for governor next year.
And I don't think he is. But I think that he remembers the event that he remembers is very different from the event we have today. I think he remembers the event when it was in his heyday before – you know, everybody who could stopped attending, you know, as began to be the case this year. And I think it's as simple as that, that he had happy memories of it and went back and expected it to be the same thing.
Yeah, Emily's still not smiling. Here's Tom Menino, Emily. Maybe this will do it for you. He did a lot of Pope jokes. So see if this one works. Here's Tom Menino.
Interesting that no one told the Pope that it was a lifetime job, you know, like mayor of Boston. So no Pope has retired in over 600 years. You see? Don't worry, guys. Only 580 more years to go. Speaking of the Pope, can you imagine someone with supreme power stepping down and allowing someone else to take over? Me either.
Charlie's laughing. I mean, you're
it's
laughing,
actually kind
Charlie.
Of cute. I mean, I can't believe he has to read all that. So wait a minute. Where was Governor Deval Patrick? I remember
he wouldn't
told
answer.
You,
we asked him on the radio.
He had a good video,
indisposed.
Though.
Where was he?
He said, I said, where are you going to be? He says, I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be out of town. And Marjorie Egan or I said, where are you going to be? He said, I'm not telling. Yeah. So I think the answer was anywhere except south of Boston. And by the way, you said he had a good video. The best line, which I think summed up the whole day, at the end, he's got a little press conference, a faux press conference. And a faux reporter is Deval little video, and he's wearing the little Mima thing. Remember, he wears it during all the storms. And a reporter, a faux reporter, says, you know, why are you wearing the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency gear? And he says, I'm wearing the Mima vest because this breakfast is so often a disaster. Which
good.
Actually
That's
was
cute.
A pretty
yeah.
good line.
It is cute.
And because it seems
are
every time.
Are we done talking about this?
Yeah.
It's still a stepping stone, though.
We'll get the ratings later today. To we'll see how
okay, fine. What would you like to talk about more? You want to talk about Rob Portman?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Fine. Major moment, Rob Portman, formerly of the Bush White House, obviously a lot of people thought he'd be running for president. He's the United States Senator from Ohio, becomes the first senator, first Republican senator to come out for gay marriage. And he said he did it because he found that his son was gay. Is this an aberration, Erin, or is this the beginning of something happening there?
Well, I'm a Buckeye at heart. So first, I was pleased.
You're an Ohio kid?
Yes, I am.
Oh, really? Okay.
Truly. And so I was pleased by it. I don't think it's an aberration, and I especially don't think the logic he used is an aberration. He was very careful to appeal to family values Republicans who are still not on board by gay marriage by referencing his family. I think he probably came around to this position a while ago, but he was able to couch it in the language of his son. Now, I know a lot of people on the left have a problem with saying you only care about it when it hits your family. But I think we'll see a lot more Republicans and moderates do this, and they'll use the friends, family, and I don't want to say excuse, but they'll use that reasoning.
Well, before you speak, Charlie, do you want to hear another Ohioan, since you're an Ohio kid? Here's John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, reacting to Portman's statement.
I believe that marriage is the union of one man and one woman. It's what I grew up with. It's what I believe. It's what my church teaches me. And I can't imagine that position would ever change.
Yeah, he would change if one of his children came just like Rob Portman did. I was a little disturbed that Rob Portman took 2 years to speak about this because apparently he did tell Mitt Romney that his son was gay. My question is,
he's being considered for the vice presidency?
Yes, he did.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes,
he was being turned down for
Yes, he did. But I wonder if he told Mitt Romney then that he supported gay marriage because, as you know, Rob Portman was not the vice presidential select. But he might have. Maybe he did tell Mitt Romney that during the vetting process.
Would have been a repeat of Dick Cheney, right? With his daughter.
His own kid, yeah.
When Boehner's not speaker, I bet he changes his tune. I mean, Hillary Clinton just came out today for it, which isn't surprising because of her.
Didn't we already know she was on board with it?
But she's setting herself up electorally, and Republicans can't do it right now. He can't keep a speakership and be for gay marriage. When he's not speaker, he might change his tune.
I agree with that. That's the way the Republican Party is right now. But, boy, he could have at least said, while I disagree, I respect Rob Portman for
it has nothing to do with what you believe.
It's
like a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of things I don't like in the world that are legal. I mean, but, you know, they're legal, and I'm glad they are. I don't like abortion. I'm glad it's legal. Gay marriage is something that I'm not going to do, but it should be legal. I'm glad it's legal. I don't like boxing. It's legal.
Do you any of you read the Borowitz Report, which I think is the best blog? But Andy Borowitz is guy. He's a very funny guy. The opening today, I think he's a riot.
Really?
Listen to this. The decision of Senator Rob Portman to support same-sex marriage after learning his son was gay has inspired hundreds of other Republican lawmakers to stop speaking to their children immediately. Which, you know, the incredible thing. We're actually, Margie Marshall, former Chief Justice of the SJC, is going to be with us in the next hour. Yeah. But, you know, all the polls you see today, it's so parallel, this Portman thing. If you say you know someone who's gay, if you're young, you overwhelmingly support it. If you're over 65 years old, you don't support it. So it's so obvious that the train is coming, which leads to the question. The oral argument is, I think, next Tuesday on Proposition 8 out of California. Despite the fact that every judge, and I'm assuming Justice Marshall, will say politics never has anything to do with it. You read the books about the Supreme Court. Politics has everything to do with lots of things. So with all these companies coming out for gay marriage, with from the Ted Olsons to the Beth Myers, who is one of the campaign managers for Mitt Romney, to Rob Portman.
Did Beth come out for
A couple of – didn't she? I hope she did. I believe so, a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So does this change the Supreme Court dynamic, Charlie?
Well, you know, we can only hope it does. I have more faith in the Supreme Court, frankly, than I do in the Republicans. Aaron has faith that, you know, that will change over time. Watching what I've been watching at CPAC the last few days makes me a little dubious about that. But I think that the Supreme Court is probably going to be a more promising venue than
the
Republican
Party. They're going to say the proposition
Party.
Is unconstitutional.
See, I disagree. I think the court's set. Irregardless of what's going on.
Set in what way?
Along ideological. This doesn't
Where's
change anything.
Vote?
What I'm saying is this doesn't change anything. Mm-hmm. I'm saying institutional. CPAC is a lot of, you would certainly say it wasn't representative of all Republicans in a negative way at CPAC, right? It's the institutional Republicans, the ones that are the most favored in the party and have the positions, are the ones who can't change right now. The Portman didn't get the VP, and he's a senator, and that's nice, but he's not really in the leadership. The Supreme Court, you know, they're set in the way they are. But as you said, the train has left the building. It's only institutional Republicans that have to speak to that base that has only changed from 21% to 25%.
Well, wait a second. Institutional Republicans in 30-some state constitutions, which say that which have an outright ban on gay marriage, they got to be undone as well.
That speaks to my point. You know, how do you get these initiative and referendums up? It's with money. It's with institutional power. When the public opinion polling amongst moderates, independents, and Democrats say we're either strongly in favor of this or we're in favor at 52-53.
You know, it's not that long ago, as I'm thinking about this Republican discussion, it's not that long ago that Barack Obama finally, quote, evolved.
It was last year, 6 months ago.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, it's not that weird that only Portman
maybe it's
is
all
amongst the Senate Republicans.
But
it's like you said about Hillary Clinton. Yeah. He finally came out and said it, but I think everybody who pays attention, you know, understood that where they stood on it. You know,
I teach.
So I don't need to ask
people.
You, Charlie. You think this is a clear sign that she's running?
I do think she's going to run, although I'm more certain about our ongoing debate about Deval Patrick running.
We've got a big
debate. I haven't heard that debate.
We have a long-standing debate.
Well, let's hear it right now. Which side are you on?
He's not running
for
president.
Oh, yes, he is.
Absolutely certain that he's
he is.
I made the mistake of saying once that he would be running, and I found out about this debate.
Three against one.
Emily, if I may, he goes to Iowa State dinners. Well, I'm not done yet. He's got a pack. He goes to New Hampshire for these things. He is the chief surrogate for the president of the United States. Now, he said, by the way, I've interviewed him. I'm sure you have, too. And he said, I got to make money after I'm done here. I want to make money. Well, he got a pretty nice check when he left either Coca-Cola or Texaco or whatever it was. He doesn't make much as governor. Why do you say it's
– He likes being all that stuff. He likes being exactly as you just described.
So
him.
Why would he not do it?
He just doesn't have it. He doesn't have it in him to do it. He's not going to do it. He's not going to run for president.
Well, I would
certainly
say,
not next time.
Yeah,
budget's a sign too.
He's the best. He's the best communicator.
The budget. I would argue the only sign that he's not running is that he's asking for a $2 billion tax increase.
It stakes a claim. It allows him to stake a claim, stake a vision, stake who he is. I think he'll run and lose. He won't get out of the presidential.
You agree with that?
That plan is a legacy move. It's the wrong thing at the wrong time, but it's the only time he can do it to do his legacy before he leaves.
You changing your mind yet, Emily? Or no?
I'm sticking with my.
Do you know something, or you're just...
what I tell you if I did?
Okay, speaking of Barack Obama, if we can, this charm offensive, after he started actually talking to Republicans, which did take 5 years, which is pretty hard to believe, but it took him almost 5 years, all the articles said this charm offensive was a big flop. His own staff were leaking reports saying he doesn't even believe in this. We hate this. It's a waste of time. And then this senator from Tennessee, right, Corker, a Republican, goes on Fox News yesterday with Chris Wallace and says this.
I think Republicans, if they saw true entitlement reform, would be glad to look at tax reform that generates additional revenues. And that doesn't mean increasing rates. That means closing loopholes. It also means arranging our tax system so that we have economic growth. And I think we've been saying that from day one.
That's Senator Corker, by the way. Emily and I are in studio with Aaron O'Brien from UMass Boston and Charlie Chipio. So is that an opening? Corker is not exactly some left-wing Republican, Aaron O'Brien.
I think it is an opening. And I think, you know, the Obama's charm offensive, I've been referring to it, it's like a really bad date. They're saying, please woo me, please woo me. The Republican said, please woo me, please take me to dinner. And then Obama takes them to dinner and does this. And they're like, oh, my God, I don't like him anymore. You know, it's just he can't win. Right? He can't win in this. And I think, you know,
well, his own
Corker
people
said
were criticizing. It wasn't just Republicans.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, it's a no-win proposition. And if he gets, you know, eviscerated in the press and by some of his own people, and Corker comes out and says this kind of thing and provides an opening, you know what? People aren't going to remember the charm offensive. They're going to remember a grand deal if it happens.
Well, first of all, what charm offensive? This is
he's having dinner with these people.
This is
even
exactly the kind of thing he's been doing since day one.
Well, no,
this
he,
is not.
He, what,
I, yeah, we like to have these little categories of things, but he's been calling people. He's been trying to make this. The truth of the matter is that Senator Bob Corker, I think, is actually onto something. If he actually said something about, you know, Medicare, essentially, said, you know, we're going to close some loopholes there. We're going to make people pay for more of their own stuff. He's probably right.
Corker's exactly right. The only question is Bob Corker talking for Bob Corker, or is he sending a message the larger party? That's the question, I think.
Well, when is a senator goes on a national Sunday show ever speak for themselves? I don't mean that physically. I mean, you get in a lot of you-know-what if you go back and it turns out you're sending a message that your McConnell's or your colleagues aren't crazy about,
that's
right?
That's absolutely true, but nonetheless, it's been known to happen.
So getting back to Emily's point, do the Democrats ever bend? I mean, Elizabeth Warren ran, I believe she ran, on a promise not to touch Social Security. And I think Medicare as well. Did the liberal-leaning Democrats say to Barack Obama, well, if you get your tax reform or whatever they call euphemism for raising taxes, we'll do something on the entitlements?
I don't see it happening. No.
You think the Democrats could be the problem?
Yeah. I'd like to see one of them move first, really. But no, I don't think – and right now Democrats aren't in a position that they have to.
I think you can get a deal without the extremes on either party.
A sort of deal, not a grand bargain. Yeah, I agree.
Making fun of the president for saying that we really don't have a debt problem for the next 10 years. Is that essentially correct?
Are you talking about it's correct with Social Security?
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's correct overall.
Why not? Next 10 years. He's saying that the next 10 years will be fine. But when that.
Well, I mean, if you consider, you know, the interest on the national debt sucking up, you know, like more money than anything, you know, than anything other than maybe two other items in the federal budget. I mean, I don't think that's fine.
No, here's
fine,
the thing.
But
nobody
Social
understands
Security's
the budget.
Not go
what
out
you're
of business.
Speaking to is very true. Like, you know, nobody understands it. The budget is a big, giant political symbol. And if I say, you know, oh, we're good for 10 years, we're good for 20 years, and you agree with me ideologically, you're like, yeah. And if you're like, we're going to be sunk, and, you know, none of these programs are solvent, and if we don't take care of the debt, we're sunk, you know, and if you agree with that position, you go with it. It's because people don't understand budgeting. They don't understand all this because it's uber complicated. So to have a discussion about, you know, the nitty gritty, everything's contested.
So let's not. Let's move on. Right, a second ago, you were talking about CPAC disparaging the Conservative Political Action Committee. It was in Maryland, right?
Yes.
This is where all the big Republicans, I guess, except for Chris Christie and the guy who's governor of Virginia, McDonald, whatever his name is, weren't invited. You seem to be disparaging of this conclave.
Well, because
I was not intentional.
I've been very down on the Republicans nationally, especially ever since summer of 2011, when we had a deal on the table where they could have gotten $5 of entitlement reform for every dollar in new taxes, and they turned it down, and they caused all this mess. I mean, look, I mean, they've just got to get real. All this sort of crazy rigid social stuff and just this, you know, no new taxes,
but
no matter
there's
what.
There's a couple of come to Jesus moments with the Latinos and saying, you know,
I just don't think
we have to. We've alienated.
Wait, did Rubio even talk about immigration at the CPAC thing? I didn't read that he did. Here's a line from Rubio. It's quoted in today's Herald. "We don't need a new idea," he says. "There is an idea. The idea is called America, and it still works." I mean, hello?
Well, and that was the division. I think what Emily's referring to is the report that came out was a lot better than the speakers.
Yes.
The speakers were somebody, we don't need to look inward. We're being disparaged. It was sort of, and that's one of them. Paul Ryan went and didn't even, all he did was talk about the budget. He didn't talk about any broader theme.
Erin, I hate to criticize you, but if you don't think that Sarah Palin talking about the Christmas gift she exchanged with Todd, here it is. It
was and I teach women in politics,
you
and this killed me. Yes.
It did?
It did.
Yes.
I liked
it's like
it.
Putting lipstick on a pig kind of thing?
You know, about the gun rack.
Yeah, well, here it is. Yeah. Let's listen up.
Oh, you should have seen what Todd got me for Christmas. Well, it wasn't that exciting. It's a metal rack, a case for a hunting rifle to put on the back of a four-wheeler. And then, though, I had to get something for him to put in the gun case, right? So this go-around, he's got the rifle, I got the rack.
Meanwhile, she looked absolutely anorexic. I have to get
that
in there.
That.
Oh,
just
my gosh. Yeah. She has an eating disorder.
I don't know if anybody – I don't usually watch, but I actually caught the end. I was at the gym, and I caught the end of –
Running
more,
fast.
Oh, that is – let me tell you. That's like people say
– Exactly.
One of my friends told me that so-and-so said, nice try, Charlie.
No, I meant
usually
like your
getting
heart
my kids
to
off
up.
To school. I don't get a chance to watch
it. Were you reading the paper
it.
At the same time? That's the one I always get.
I believe you.
I was at the gym, and I was watching Morning Joe. I was watching the end of Morning Joe. And they played that, and Mika Brzezinski turned around and walked off the set. She was so angry, she turned around and walked off.
That's a little dramatic. Huh?
But, you know, no, it's a little dramatic that gets coverage. I mean, listen, Sarah Palin is now irrelevant, by and large, but she's not because we prop her up. And, you know, I know she had other portions of the speech. I heard about soda, and I heard about Iraq. She is playing to a media frame that works.
She's a sideshow.
Yeah, hey, no,
guys,
but,
one
but
thing
she
that came
gets
out of
played.
This that I think does matter before we say goodbye to you guys is Rand Paul, who pre-drone, it seems to me, was seen as son of Ron Paul and really nothing more. A young, sort of quirky, curmudgeon-y libertarian. I think he broadened his base with the whole drone thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of liberals loved it and loved that he was criticizing the president because they didn't have the courage to criticize the president. But he did, and he did come in first a little bit over Rubio. Paul has got a different foundation, Charlie Chipio. Does
well,
he not?
I mean, let's see where that's going. It's promising, but he's also got a long history of being out there on the fringe, and we'll see if that changes.
See, Pat, I agree with you. The filibuster, people loved it on the left and especially on the right, standing up to the president on what many on the left think they should be doing. But he would if this was CPAC 2015, he never would have gotten those votes.
Beautifully put. Erin O'Brien from UMass, it's a pleasure. Charlie Chipio from Chipio Strategies. I love the name,
like
Charlie.
That. Wow.
Really,
pretty creative, huh?
I like it. Great to see you both. Thanks for stopping by.
All right,
you.
I'm Emily Rooney, along with Jim Browdy. Next up, is it ironic that the discovery of the so-called God particle was all but confirmed at the very same time over 100 cardinals gathered in Vatican City to elect the new pope? We're going to tease out the God element from the Higgs boson article next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm Jim Browdy. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. She is Emily Rooney, sitting in for the vacationing Marjorie Egan. We're about to discuss something, Emily, I understand absolutely nothing about.
I don't really either. My daughter's into this. Though.
Really?
Big time. My daughter's into astronomy and science, so she's been very
excited about
this.
Where is she when we need her? Well, that's Higgs boson, if you don't know, with a physicist who is a pioneer in the field of superstring theory, something else I know absolutely nothing about. Joining us, with, I guess, Higgs boson for dummies, is a professor of math and physics at Columbia. He's author of many books, including The Elegant Universe. And if you're a PBS fan, we hope you are, you know him from his special, The Hidden Reality. Rescue us and welcome Brian Greene. Yes. Hi, Brian.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Brian,
well, I hope we're going to be doing better in 10 minutes.
Please rescue us. So I am interested in this, and I got one of my curiosities was about why they called it the God particle. Well, the more I read into it and then I listened to an NPR interview, it was actually started as a joke, as the significance being that you assign God to things that are unknown or you don't really understand. So, but in truth, what we do understand is more vast than that. And so do we wish it weren't called the God particle at this point?
Yeah, well, the joke is actually even a little bit different. It came from Nobel laureate Leon Lederman, who is a famous particle physicist who's been hunting, one of many people hunting this Higgs particle for a very long time. And it was so hard to find that he wanted to call his book on the subject the goddamn particle.
I did see that,
but the publishers didn't like that so much, so they shortened it to the God particle, and it kind of stuck. But we physicists really don't like that name because this really has nothing to do with God or religion at all.
I thought it should be the no-God particle, and then that might work.
Say it again?
The no-God particle, because it explains...
You could go that direction, yeah. But what we're really trying to do is answer a basic question, which is, why does matter have heft? Why does it have mass? Why, when you push against something, does it offer resistance?
Like running in water, that was a good example. Yeah,
and this particle is a potential answer to those kinds of questions.
We're talking to Brian Greene. If you have questions or comments about Higgs boson, feel free to give him a call, 877-301-8970. Brian Greene, why should we mere mortals care about this discovery, which obviously is huge, even though I'm not quite getting it yet?
Well, not everybody should per se. I mean, my mom doesn't. And still wishes I was a doctor. You know, I try to tell her I am a doctor, but she means the other kind of doctor. You know, so not everybody will. But I should say this. If you have any curiosity about how the world is put together and why the universe is the way it is, this Higgs idea is a vital part of that story that has been going on for 2,500 years. We've been asking, what are things made of? How do they come together to make the world around us? This particle is a vital part of that story. Many people are curious about it.
You know, Brian Greene, when I read the thing last week about saying that it seems that your colleagues have confirmed the existence, what if it turns out it doesn't exist? What if it turns out the findings that ultimately the conclusion is there is no Higgs boson particle, if I'm using the proper terminology? What will that mean in the world of physics?
Well, it'll be even more exciting. I mean, it is great that this Higgs particle, we believe, has been confirmed because it's been within our theoretical description, within our mathematical ideas for over 40 years. And it is a stunning confirmation when an idea begins as scribbles on a piece of paper that come out of physicists' minds, and then we can confirm it in the laboratory. But if it turned out that we have not found the Higgs, that would be more exciting still because it would force us to rethink the foundations of everything we thought we understood. And I have to tell you, that's what we physicists live for that kind of major upheaval where we have to rethink the foundations of reality.
Brian, when quantum physics or quantum mechanics, I might have those two confused, so I'm not sure which is which, but people were saying the same thing, like, what will this lead to? And then I went back and looking at that. I mean, you know, it led to development of new technology, computers, I mean, everything. It's just sort of this explosive change of technology. What will this lead to, the Higgs boson? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, it's very hard to say, and your analogy is a great one, because in the 1920s, when quantum physics, quantum mechanics was being developed, it was not obvious that it would matter to everyday life. After all, the idea seemed so esoteric. And yet, as you're pointing out, 80, 100 years later, those discoveries have changed everyday life. The fact that you have a cell phone, the fact that there's wondrous medical technologies, laptop computers, it all relies on quantum physics because it all relies on the integrated circuit that comes out of those discoveries. Where will the Higgs idea lead in 80 or 100 years from now? I don't know. It's very hard to imagine. But we are gaining a very deep understanding of how matter is put together. And once you understand something really well, you can then begin to use that understanding to manipulate, to mold, to create new things.
One of the things I think that is bothersome to me anyway, when I started making an analogy to the Catholic Church, we spent so much time debating over whether Catholics believe or the Pope believes, you know, birth control should be distributed in third world nations. So these are things that we can all understand. We can have a debate about. But it's sort of ancient compared to this new technology. And yet, because so many of us don't really understand this, we don't have the debate about it. How do we make this issue accessible to people like me and Jim Brody?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a critical question. And I spend a lot of time thinking about it. That's why I write popular level books, as many other physicists do as well. You know, the PBS shows that I've done with Nova, again, are trying to bring this material to a wide audience. And a new initiative that I'm undertaking right now is to work with the World Science Festival in New York to create a whole range of programming, live programming for the general public, as well as online courses that will be available in a couple months. So anybody who's interested in this stuff, go to worldsciencefestival.com, sign up, and we will be providing digestible, really entertaining approaches to these wondrous ideas.
Honestly, I was actually on the Wikipedia page today. I couldn't follow any of it.
No, and by the way, it's not just important for reasons of intellectual curiosity, like I think Emily was describing a minute ago, Brian. It seems, but when you're in the science community, and by the way, we're talking to Brian Greene, a professor of math and physics at Columbia University. It seems to me at times when scientific research is often at the chopping block, when you're talking fiscal cliffs and sequesters, the more the public both understands this stuff and then also understands its potential importance and value in their lives or the kids' lives or whatever, the sturdier you all become. Is that not a fair statement?
It's absolutely fair. I'd even go a step further than that. It's hard for me to see how going forward we can have a healthy democracy without a general public that is engaged with scientific ideas. And the reason is the big decisions and the big opportunities that we have going forward across the board, from stem cell research, genetically modified foods, climate change, nuclear proliferation, I mean, all of that stuff and everything else that really is going to matter going forward has a scientific basis. So how can you have a democracy if the general public isn't engaged with the very ideas that need to inform decision making?
Is one of the facts that, the problems that it flies in the face of what people believe about God and the creation of Earth and their destiny? I mean, is that one of the problems?
No, I don't agree that has to be where the stumbling block is. It could well be that the religious ideas are right. I don't see evidence for it, but it could be that God's behind us all. But the point is, we still can use the ideas of science, the language and the approach that we have developed over thousands of years to understand the world in a way where we can predict things and manipulate things in a way that will be better for all of us. So they don't have to be at odds with one another. I mean, clearly, science is able to make wondrous drugs. Science is able to create wondrous gadgetry that we all make use of. That's unassailable. And people need to not just use the fruits of science, they need to try to grasp the underlying ideas. The real problem is not religion, it's schooling. In our schools, we don't teach science in a way that makes kids sit up straight and say, "Whoa, how spectacular is that?" Rather, we make them memorize facts. So if we can change the way we bring science to kids, that will make the big difference.
Well, it's not just exciting. I want to get back to what I said a minute ago. We're talking to Brian Greene from Columbia. And if you do want to talk to him about the Higgs boson, and unless you're too intimidated, as I feel, at 877-301-8970, NASA had its funding put at risk. And one of the things, they went on this PR offensive in which every NASA astronaut, every NASA executive went to some radio and television show to say all the products that are critical in our lives, from microwaves to Teflon to whatever, was a result of the taxpayer investment. And so beyond the intellectual curiosity, that part of it is really an important element in making the case and getting public support, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, science has changed life in dramatic ways. And it's not often the case that people that use the fruits of science recognize the intellectual heritage of the gadgetry that they're using, or the drug that's saving their life, or the piece of equipment that's saving their family member's life. And it's vital to see that linkage, because basic research is at the core of it all.
Okay, here's your chance.
Funding for basic research, you're going to cut the kinds of things that we are going to invent and discover.
Okay, Brian Greene, let's go back to the beginning of this discussion. You have 30 to 60 seconds to explain to Emily Rooney and me and our listeners exactly what Higgs boson is. Take it away.
Well, the basic idea is this. Why do the basic particles like electrons and quarks, the particles that make up matter, why do they have mass, heft? Where does it come from? Here's the proposal. Space itself, the idea goes, is filled with an invisible something that's sort of like an invisible molasses that permeates every nook and cranny of space. And as particles try to move through this so-called Higgs field, this Higgs molasses, they experience a drag force. Think of a pebble going through molasses. It experiences drag. And that drag is what we call the mass of a particle. So how would you confirm this idea? Well, at the big machine in Geneva, they slam protons together at very high speed, trying to jiggle the molasses, jiggle the Higgs field to flick off a little speck. And that little speck would be a Higgs particle or a Higgs boson. And that's the particle that we believe we have finally found.
All right. So, Brian, what's the difference between what happened 6 months ago and what happened late last week?
What happened late last week is a more refined analysis of the data, which is now giving an even stronger case that the particle is what we think it is. It's the particle that comes out of our theories.
So I thought it was confirmed.
It's basically, now have more confidence that this particle has been found.
So do we. McCusker is on the phone from Westwood, and you're talking to Brian Greene from Columbia University and PBS. Hey, McCusker.
How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. What's going on?
I have a joke. Higgs boson particle walks into a church.
Yeah.
Priest comes out and tells them to leave, and the particle says, "You can't have mass without me."
Emily's not laughing.
No,
I am.
Cute.
What do you think, Brian Greene? Are you going to use that in your next lecture?
I do. I have heard it before about 1,000 times, but it's still funny. It is funny.
McCusker, that was excellent.
McCusker, did you watch The Breakfast yesterday?
Of course.
See, I could tell. How did I know, Jim? He's one of your guys.
McCusker, thank you so much for calling. So what's next, Brian Greene? And now that there is a greater level of confirmation, for lack of a better term, what's next potentially based on what you've seen the last 6-7 months?
Well, this Large Hadron Collider in Geneva has the capacity to find yet other particles that our theories suggest should be there but as yet have not been found. These particles typically go by the name of supersymmetric particles. It's a fairly complex mathematical theory that leads to them. But if we could find these new particles, it would again take us one step further on the road toward the deep understanding of how the world is put together.
You know, Brian Greene, I read this morning, that's over the weekend, this large, is it Hadron Collider?
Hadron?
Correct, yeah.
$10.5 billion. Where'd the dough come from for this thing? Who's the
What does it look like, by the way?
Yep.
And what does it look like? That's a great question.
Have you been there? What does it look like? What is this thing?
It's an 18-mile circumference tunnel that is partly under Geneva, winds its way across the French border and back. And it's surrounded by these mammoth detectors so that when particles collide in this tunnel and they create a spree, spread of debris, the debris is captured by these detectors and analyzed by fantastically powerful computers. And the money came from a variety of countries that pooled resources in order to be able to foot the bill. And
is our country one of them?
Yeah, we definitely are part of it, although the issue is one of historical relevance. We were going to build our own machine in Waxahachie, Texas, called the Superconducting Supercollider. That would have been far more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider. But we got partway down that road, and Congress cut funding for it, and it went away. So that is a sore point for the particle physics experimenters in this country. We'd prefer to have it here.
All right, Brian Greene, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University.
My pleasure.
Author of many books, including The Elegant Universe. Only one question, Jim, that tells you we're not the only ones intimidated by this.
You're lecturing on this at 7 o'clock, in downtown Boston. Where is that location again?
We're going to segue to a topic that has long plagued the North End, and that's the two-wheel tourism machine known as the Segway. To love them or loathe them? That's the conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Innovation, always starts with a conversation. And that's at the heart of what the Venture Cafe is about.
Every Thursday, the fourth floor of the Cambridge Innovation Center in Kendall Square is buzzing. But it isn't just from the free beer and wine.
If you want to stay current and know what the future is going to bring, someone here is working on it.
I'm Liz Alessi, the story of the Venture Cafe, this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, with more than 30 years of experience and 15 locations throughout New England, New York, and Washington, D.C., offering local, long-distance, and international moving services. GentleGiant.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and Emily Rooney is with me today. We're going to talk about the Segway with you at 877-301-8970. It's had a checkered history. It all started with rumors that New Hampshire's Dean Kamen had the invention of the century, and then we saw it. In the words of Peggy Lee, many said, is that all there is? And then a new owner of the firm experienced this.
Kind of an odd story. You know the Segway? The bike-like thing that scoots around on two wheels. Police sometimes use them. Sometimes even commuters use them. The owner of the company was riding one this weekend and somehow had an accident and was killed. Jim Heseldon was 62. Heseldon was riding on his estate in northern England and fell off a cliff. Police are calling it an accident. One would think so, yeah.
Yeah, one would think so. So in any case, he rode the cliff.
You didn't find humor in that, so, did you?
No, it's not humor. It's an irony. Odd sort of irony. Thank you.
It was 80 feet he fell off. That's quite a cliff on your own property.
I know, and he died. He was a very wealthy man. And now everybody, I assume you read the Globe story, the Segway headquarters in North End is threatened with eviction for some zoning violation. So Emily and I, both of whom, by the way, have ridden a Segway, will with you debate the pros and cons of the Segway. Give us a call, 877-301-8970. You pro Segway or anti Segway?
I live downtown, so I do see these tours, which are, by the way, mostly in the North End, which is probably the worst place to take a Segway.
Because it's so tight for those of you.
So if it was around the Boston Public Library, you know, Copley Square or Park Square, it would be okay. But I think the North End is the absolute worst place to do it. And also, if they're on the sidewalk, you really can't be, even if they're single file. I mean, I like the idea of the Segway, but I wish they were...
It was fun doing it. Did you have fun doing it?
I had huge fun. I tried going upstairs. That didn't work so well. Did you?
I didn't know I was supposed to go upstairs, actually.
And down.
No, I actually appeared in a movie. That's true.
He always one-ups me.
No, it's totally true. There was a movie. Some young guys did the Segway all across America. It's called something like America at 10 Miles Per Hour. They come out to NECN. They have me riding on a Segway outside where I'm doing fine. You know, you just essentially move your body a drop and the Segway reacts to it. And you go, it's pretty easy to learn and you learn pretty quickly. They had me try to maneuver the Segway in the newsroom. So not only am I bumping in everything, but they take the video of me from behind and below.
Ooh,
so
nice.
Essentially all you see in the film is 15 seconds of my whatever riding a Segway. The problem with the Segway, and you touch on it, at least as far as I'm, because I love the concept at least, it's too slow, and too cumbersome for a sidewalk, and it's too slow than the road.
For
so
the
there's
street.
No place for it to go.
Actually, I have a good story too, because I was invited to something at that MIT robotics lab. This was before Dean Kamen actually had that infamous press conference, because there was all kinds of robotics there. I mean, it was a really creepy baby that was just like a baby, you know, crying baby, and had all the limbs moving and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was a robotic baby. But he had this thing, too, and everybody who was there got on the thing. We didn't go far, but I did try the steps, because that was his thing, that this was going to be a great thing for not somebody who was disabled or completely handicapped, but couldn't walk and couldn't keep up, and that they would be able to use this device to go shopping, to go around grocery stores, to get around their neighborhoods. But really, no, you have to have a little bit more physical agility, I think, didn't you?
Didn't he invent the wheelchair that goes upstairs?
Yeah,
I thought
yeah.
it's his other great. So the theory, I didn't know this, that the Segway is supposed to do stairs too?
Yes, it does do stairs.
I didn't. I was totally unaware of that. 877-301-8970. If you have any experience with a Segway or you want to have an experience with a Segway, you know, I wasn't clear when I was reading the Globe story this morning. It appears, have they been banned from Boston sidewalks? It appears that they
certain
have, correct?
Neighborhoods and they have flagrantly violated that. They're now up to fines of upwards of $200,000, which they say they are not going to pay.
This North End guy, the business down there.
He says they pay the fees for the tours and all that. So I'm a little unclear. Is that that gas station that was there forever and ever?
Yes,
and
I think it was,
okay,
actually.
Okay, so that on the corner there. They kept,
and it's apparently only zoned for a gas station. Yeah.
Only zoned for gas for $7.50 a gallon, too, by the way. So, I mean, that was an outrageous gas station. But it's a good place for that because they've got the space. They can park the extra Segway. So it seems like it's not a bad location for it. But they're saying it's only zoned for a gas station. What are they talking about? It's only zoned for a gas station.
Well, you know, I don't know what the answer is, except that's why part of the reason why he's got a couple $100,000 in fine. What is the purpose, though, other than an odd experience, which it was? And I really did like it, and I love the fact that I was able, because I'm not the most coordinated soul who has ever walked or segwayed.
And you need a new knee, but other than that.
Well, that too, but that's unrelated to the Segway. What is the point, other than mall cops? And you see some malls, you go to a mall, big malls, they're the guards or whatever they're called are riding Segways. What is the function supposed to be? Are people supposed to commute or get around town on a Segway?
Get around town. For instance, Beacon Hill. If you're on a tour of Beacon Hill, I mean, it's vigorous going up and down the hills and all around Lewisburg Square and everything. You take one of these little tours on the Segway, it helps you get around. The groups keeps together. Everybody can stay in one pack. Then that's the idea behind it. It's not a terrible idea. It's just that certain neighborhoods, they just flat out don't work.
It is a terrible idea because, as I said, you can't go any. You can't do the sidewalk. You can't do the street.
They do the sidewalks.
Plus, it cost, at least when it came out, it was like $3,000. I have no idea. I should have checked this morning as to how expensive it is. It's just, it doesn't seem.
People pay that much for a bicycle these days.
I understand they do. But a bicycle is much more. I'm not a huge pro bicycle. And city
yeah, we're
going
to have a big debate on that later in the spring.
So I hear, actually. But it's too cumbersome. Did you use the word cumbersome? I think it's cumbersome to get through the city streets. By the way, this is a great bite from The Daily Show. During 2010 election night coverage, Daily Show made fun of Washington, D.C.'s Segway love affair. This is their correspondent, Jason Jones, reporting live from a Segway.
Where are you tonight, Jason Jones?
John, I don't know. I have no idea, really, where the hell I mean, the street signs is just a green and white blur. I might not make it back.
Jason, why are you on a Segway?
I don't know. I mean, for some reason, these two-wheeled nerdmobiles, which the rest of the country long ago dismissed as ridiculous, are hugely popular here. I don't know how to work this damn thing.
All right.
You know, it's interesting. When he says nerdmobile, I can't believe I forgot that. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Biggest problem is when you have a little helmet and you're standing upright.
You look like
you look like a total fool.
You might be
there's
off
nothing
on a razor.
Cool. What's that?
You'd be better off on a razor.
You probably would be going through the streets. Our number is 877-301-8970. Do you know anybody who owns a Segway? You don't, do
no,
you?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't. And that's the other thing. I mean, Dean came and predicted that this was going to be the transformative piece of transportation equipment in our lifetimes, and we would all have one by, I think, you know, this thing came out in 2001.
Right.
And other than the tours in the North End and around Beacon Hill, I've never seen one.
Well, the malls. You don't go to malls enough.
I don't.
It's because you don't take public transportation. You can't get to the malls.
Exactly.
But, you know, and not only when you say Dean Kamen predicted this, Dean Kamen's a New Hampshire inventor who was behind this thing. The media fell for it, too. Don't you? It was almost like Y2K-ish.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody
it was
playing in this. The big, what could it be? There was all the speculation. What is it? I remember some people were talking about a jet-propelled something that got you from place to place.
Oh, yeah, those jetpacks.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden it came out, and there was absolutely – there was nothing. Even
well,
though
isn't
I did,
that partly because we had already known about the Segway, and then he came out – I think so.
No, I don't think that's true.
I thought we had already known about it, and we were going, what? What? The Segway? I thought we already knew about that thing.
877-301-8970. I really want, there's got to be somebody out there
who
is loving the experience. 877-301-8970. And, you know, you sort of got to like, if you're a Segway person, while some may consider you a nerd, you're also sort of a, I guess, a risk taker. The guy who is head of the Segway thing down there, which is, I guess, used to be called Boston Gliders. It's now called Boston by Segway. It said, one, he's not moving. Two, what's his name, Downing or something? Two, he is not. He has no intention of paying the $200,000 in fine.
I respect him for that. Yeah, but
how do you get away?
I like that.
What do they do? They attach your property? They attach your...
Tell somebody what kind of a business they can have? It's like...
Well, if it's
see restaurants that are – look what just happened with Restoration Hardware. That was Louis Boston. Now it's supposedly a hardware store if it ever opens. But it's like, who can tell you what kind of a business
because
they have?
Because I think the answer is if people believe that it's a danger to residents and tourists, and as you said, the North End is one of the tightest places in the city, then it's an issue.
No, but they're telling you you can only have a gas station on that property.
Because
if you remove the gas tank,
because under
what's the
zoning
difference?
Laws, it's not just because it's only a gas station. It's because under zoning laws, a gas station doesn't, I guess, their theory, this local zoning board concludes, doesn't put anybody at risk there. Segways put people
at
risk.
A gas station doesn't put you more at risk than a Segway?
I believe,
came along with a lighted match,
well, I don't think the expectation is that – and if you came along with a nuclear bomb, it would be really scary too. Let's go to the phones. Mike, you're in Rhode Island. Have you done the Segway thing or have you not? Hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
No,
I have not ridden one.
And?
But I think you guys are – off the track a little bit.
Probably so. Why?
Well, listen, Dean Kamen's a genius. Yeah. And he is also someone who's very concerned about the environment. And the way it all happened and the way the press attacked it, it could have been much more than what it was. I think his intent, and I could be wrong here, but I think his intent was we were supposed to build around the Segway. Our cities were supposed to be built around it. So yes, it doesn't work in the way the cities are now. But if we stopped for a moment, okay, and said that this instrument was going to be the best way for people in urban areas to travel, we would have to build a new infrastructure around it. It just didn't happen that way.
No, it wasn't just because people were making fun. I mean, there was no way to really carry anything substantial on a Segway. And you're, as Jim points out, you're standing up. I mean, it's an awkward situation all around.
Well, it's awkward. I definitely think he tooted his own horn a little quick. But I think, and this is all I really want to get across, is that I think his intentions were pure.
Yeah, maybe they were, but let's get back because I'm open-minded here. Why is he a genius exactly?
Well, you know he invented dialysis, right?
Well, no, he didn't actually invent dialysis. He invented the insulin pump. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
One piece
correct.
Of the action. I'm not saying, listen,
correct.
Obviously he's a smart science guy, but if, as you say, the expectation was the world is going to build around his device and nobody's built around the device and virtually nobody can afford the device except a mall cop, then maybe he's not, or maybe he is. But Mike, thank you kindly for the call. Let's go to Tony.
Yeah, I think sounds interesting.
Tony, you're in a car. Are you in a car or wherever
yes,
you
ma'am.
Are? Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy. Hey, Tony.
Listen, I worked for a distributor for a number of years, and I probably have done 1,000 demos on Segways, and you're absolutely correct. You can learn to ride it very quickly. The novelty of everybody and their brother having one is definitely worn off because they're over $6,000 now on the mid-range machine. But we put together a couple of industrial applications, one with the saddlebags, putting a first responders kit on it for places like, factories and big stadiums and places like that where you could respond with a defibrillator and a first aid kit much quicker because it'll go over 12 miles an hour in its top range speed. And it runs for several hours on a charge. The other thing was up in an oil refinery in Canada, we fitted out the people that did the surveying of the tanks. They were able to get around quicker. Not so much in the snow, but they do have a snow tire available. Up there, and there is some application for it, but it's got to be specific. You got to be able to know the marketplace, and then you got to be able to demonstrate in such a way that the people that are looking at it, watching it, realize that there's a value that is added to their operation.
Hey, Tony, getting back to the corporate uses you talk, is it catching on in some parts of the corporate world like you described, or no?
Not nearly as much as Dean Kamen thought. And yeah. Getting back to the question you asked about Dean Kamen, he took basically a gyro and fitted it on a platform that responds to change in attitude of that platform in just minute detail as far as, like you say, you lean forward, it goes forward, you lean back, it stops. As far as turning, you just lean one way and the machine will turn in its own footprint.
Hey, Tony, before you go, do you have a segue?
I do not have one, but I have access to them because the girl that has the distributorship has allowed me to demonstrate the machine in different applications, including hospitals and the large pharmaceutical operations.
How many did you sell?
Oh, God, I don't know. Maybe 35, 40.
Ugh, no wonder you don't work for them anymore.
So is there a future, Tony, for this or no?
I think there is, but there has to be some specifics as far as what industries can capitalize on this, and I don't think the present ownership is doing any marketing to speak of it in that area.
Yeah, Tony, thanks for calling. You know, Emily, when you come into GBH in the morning and you have to go, you get
that
up in the elevator,
it's
endless.
A long ways.
Is that perfect for a segue?
Yes,
would be.
We could leave them on either end. And
I love
could,
that.
It's a
Maybe
long
you and I
ways,
can get together.
A couple hundred yards.
Let's squeeze one more quick one. And Ann and Worcester, we're talking segues. Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
All I want to say is that, you know, I'm totally against the segue for a lot of reasons, but my son lives in Washington. And so you're on a Sunday stroll, you know, to Smithsonian, and you're just kind of relaxing. But you got to realize the open streets in Washington, they go about 12 miles an hour. You're jumping out of the way, literally, of the segways on and a tourist going right across
the street
without even thinking.
Are they running in packs? Are they all rented together, or how does that work?
Yeah, they run in packs. There's some, you know, there's some, and I don't know who, if it's like, so some of the police have them, which is probably a good idea. But I'm telling you, the tourists on them are really dangerous because there's nothing
well,
like
at
know,
least
the streets
have
to slow down.
Streets and sidewalks in Washington, D.C. are about 10 times as wide as they are in Boston.
There's Segway gangs in Washington made up of nerds. You know that? It's
seriously.
Also, hey, Ann, thanks for calling. You know what Ann touched on? Not only are they dangerous on the sidewalk for everybody, if you're an older person and you're not moving around terribly well, they're deadly. I can't believe there have not been other incidents other than that. The founder, or not the founder,
and
the owner,
person,
going off a cliff.
I shouldn't. We had that elderly discussion, but somebody who's slightly infirm would have a hard time using it. Don't you agree? I mean,
using a Segway,
I think they would.
No, actually, no. One, if you can stand up. I mean, if you can't stand up, you can. But didn't you? I was worried I wouldn't be able to figure it out.
Yeah.
It takes about 30 seconds,
yeah,
and then all
hard.
Of a sudden, it's just reacting to you. It's a really great thing. So Emily and I are probably going to buy one. So
we
get from the elevator to the newsroom.
You're bigger than me, so you're going to have to pay the lion's share.
Thank you.
I
will do that, of course.
All right. Coming up next, Reverend Eugene Rivers joins us for open mic. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Seven out of every $10 spent on daily operations here at 89.7 WGBH come directly from listener support. And thousands of WGBH supporters double the impact of their financial contributions by having them matched dollar for dollar by their employers. To find out if your employer will join you in supporting WGBH radio and television, visit wgbh.org/matchinggifts.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health.
Radio. Here with us in the studio is the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Welcome, Eugene Rivers. So I understand you were part of the big breakfast in South Boston yesterday with Jim Browdy hosting.
What were you doing there?
What were you doing there?
I was coming to pay my political taxes.
What does that mean?
This is a high tribal festival celebration. And so, and I've actually.
Have you ever been before?
Oh, and I've gone for like last 10 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No, I'd go there and I'd take my chapstick and my knee pads and
That's beautifully
kiss those rings,
put there, Gene Rivers.
Right, right. No, absolutely. No,
now,
no.
When Steve Lynch opened his, I don't know if you call it a speech, his routine, whatever it was.
Yeah.
After he talked about a lot of veterans who were in the room or families of Gold Star mothers, that sort of thing, he said, I want to thank Father so-and-so for his blessing. And I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah.
And I want to thank Reverend Eugene Rivers for his blessing. What was that about?
Actually, you know what's a funny thing? I wasn't even there.
Well, trust me, it happened. I heard it.
Are you serious?
Did you? Oh, I'm totally serious.
Did you do it?
Did you bless him or something? What did you do?
No. On my way out,
I
said, bless you, you know, because I do that, right?
Yeah.
And, I get there. This is what happens. I get there at like 7:45, and I stay till 9:30, right?
Smart.
So I go
before it starts.
Yeah. So I get there, you know, and all the guys, and I'm walking around there, you know, doing my thing. And what's fascinating, I'm one of the handful of blacks that I got to watch my language, who actually goes. Because, frankly, in this town, to get things done, if you're black and it's gonna require broad-based support, you go to that high, holy, tribal event, and you make friends, build bridges, and it's always surprising because there's a group of the Irish that are just so unaccustomed to seeing blacks. And then I go, you know, no, it really is true because, you know, it's a sort of a South Boston kind of thing. And
Funny, I didn't see it at the Chinese New Year's.
What's that now?
I didn't see it at the Chinese New Year's event, which is very
And you
similar.
Probably won't.
Yeah.
So do you have a dream that someday Linda Dorsina-Forey will be emceeing the St. Patrick's Day breakfast? She's one of the three candidates for the State Senate, which includes South Boston. And I think I asked her when she was here a week ago. She would chair it if she would emcee it.
Sure.
Should she be elected? Can you imagine that scene?
No.
Can I imagine it? Well, I guess since I can imagine a lot of things that won't happen, yeah, I can imagine. Lots of good.
Well, it's only 25% of the district, by the way. And she's campaigning hard in that part of the district, too.
God bless her.
I can't see her doing it.
Well, no, because I'll tell you what's funny.
Not that being funny is the criterion, because
No. Because I caught a tape of her thing.
Yeah.
And I remember Weld and Billy Bolger, and that was funny.
That was the best that ever was.
That was funny. Yeah, that was
You stayed for that.
Oh yeah.
You didn't leave at 9:30.
No, that was good. Okay. No, I saw Bill Weld yesterday. We had a nice little chat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, speaking of conclaves, the Pope. We all the first thing we heard about this Pope, which most of us knew nothing about him in advance, and we thought if it was South America, it was going to be the guy Shearer from Brazil. First thing we heard about him was he lives in his own apartment.
Yeah.
He sheds
the bus,
all the
he pays
whatever
his own
does
hotel
the bus.
Bills.
And
yeah.
apparently,
right, right.
on day one in Rome, I believe he also did a bus. Kind of thing. And the story that I actually liked was, I liked a few of the stories. One of the stories I liked is apparently when he was about to reach 77 votes, a cardinal from Brazil, I don't know if it was this one or if there's another one, my apologies, walks over, hugs him and says, when you're elected, don't forget about the poor. Should we be hopeful on that front that this guy is going to do something about poverty and poor people around the world, Gene Rivers?
We should be hopeful for two reasons that have nothing to do with purity. Right? There are two reasons. No. One reason is, I think, politically, given the bad hair years the Catholic Church has had on the sexual molestation stuff, if I were a PR person retained by the Vatican, I'd be doing the poor to offset the just horrific, crazy, I don't really get it. Stuff that happens.
That's the gospel according to Marjorie Egan, by the way, for years. That's what they should be doing. So you think they should.
I think they should, and they will.
Is that your...
But did they stop? I mean, certainly locally that was not the case. I mean, the Catholic Church has gotten a bad rap for some things, fairly.
Yeah.
But unfairly for the fact that they have been the backbone
of the charity. Let me tell you something. Emily, you are so on. If you travel around the world and you go to South, Central, and American Africa, they are the only ones there. Period. End of story.
Well, by the way, you don't need to travel those places. You go to Beacon Hill.
Yeah.
And even during the sex abuse crisis, we're going to talk about Cardinal Law and his encounter with the Pope the other day. Law, O'Malley, they are the first ones in line at those endless hearings at the Gardner Auditorium talking about poor people and their benefits. They're good on the issue.
Emily, listen.
I'm Jim. She's Emily. I'm sorry.
I was talking to Emily.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, Reverend Rivers, yes.
Okay, right. No, on the issue of the poor, The Roman Catholics globally are the best. There's simply no one that comes close in terms of time, talent, and treasure. You know, those nuns, those priests that were working with AIDS orphans, right, when people were really paranoid about it. All throughout Africa, the ones that are leading the charge, there's a place called the Kibera slum in Nairobi, Kenya.
And there's actually a guy who started, you know, Carolina for Kibera out of North Carolina, this
yes,
kid, who
right.
while he's in Iraq,
that's right.
while he's serving in yes. Iraq, he started this nonprofit in the worst slums.
It is the
he's
worst slum.
I can't think of his name for the moment, but he's unbelievable.
In fact, you have to park the car 2 miles away because you can't get into the place because it's just... And
what's
nuns,
going on in there?
It's poverty. It makes Haiti look like Bel Air. It's horrific. It is just open sewage everywhere. And I'm walking through the Kibera slum, and there are, I think, the Sisters of Mercy. And these priests, they're serving, doing hospice care for all these dying babies. It's unbelievable. And so just multiply that all across the continent. They're the best. You know, it's tragic, and there've got to be some very tough conversations around the sexual abuse stuff. But they're
so
the best.
So why did this Pope feel he needed to reaffirm that that was the mission, that that was going to be his mission? And really, that's what it's been all along.
You know, what I pick up that's, like, real, this guy is... A theological conservative on probably two issues, the abortion stuff and marriage, right? He is going to go hard left.
And gay adoption. Everything gay he is.
Right. Okay. But he's going to go hard left on the poor. Nobody's going to beat him. And it's real. Those people go there and they get the job done, and they're unrecognized throughout the world.
By the way, the guy's name who's fabulous, Rye Barcott is his name. I've interviewed him a bunch of times. And again, it's called Carolina, as in North Carolina.
Carolina, that's right. That's
so
right.
What was the reason you brought that up? What does he do? I mean, while the symbols are nice, and I actually believe in symbols because they send pretty powerful messages if you follow up symbolism with action.
Yeah.
What does this guy do to show he's the real deal? What should he do as one of his first acts? See, I think, continuing the symbolism, and I don't know if you're allowed to, I assume he's the boss, he can do what he wants. If you can move out of your sumptuous apartment in Buenos Aires or in Boston, as Sean O'Malley did.
Absolutely.
How huge would it be if this guy said, I'm not living in this palatial thing.
Probably
I'm
going to
live in
an
apartment on the ground, something within the Vatican walls. I mean, that'd be huge. But then what does he do, not symbolically, Gene Rivers, to show this is the mission of the new Roman Catholic Church?
What's going to happen is that substantively, he's going to push the Roman Catholic Church on the poverty agenda for reasons that are completely legit. Given the extraordinary, you know, obscene, you know, economic inequality that all the good liberals talk about, right? No, in fact, I'll tell you the interesting irony. Twice. Globally, these churches are going to be the leading institutions of civil society with the decline of interventionist states across the globe. So as states and governments get smaller, given the global economic trends, the only institutions left in civil society are going to be these people. And if you travel the world, it's a no-brainer because you go to these wretched places that nobody's going to go with open sewage. Mm. And the only people you're going to find are some nuns and some priests. They're serving these poor people with some Paul Farmer types, right, who's also Roman Catholic, right, down there serving the poor.
Okay, so on one hand, he's doing all the symbolic things to show that he was for real, including taking on the husband of the president of Argentina on issues of income inequality.
God bless him.
And on the other hand, he does something that I find practically abhorrent. We may have a dispute about this.
Sure.
He has a, quote, brief but friendly meeting with Cardinal Law as he goes into the Mary Major Basilica that Law presides over. There was a false report that he had said, that he, Pope Francis, has said, I want him out of there, meaning Law. I want him in a monastery. There was brief celebration amongst the survivors and sort of thing.
Just to clarify, though, he met with each of the popes, the cardinals who are no longer eligible to vote. So it
over
wasn't
80.
Just... Cardinal Law was all of them.
Yeah, but despite having said that, and I'll say this to both of you, it seems to me that when you are perceived, I think correctly, as the leader of one of the largest pedophilia rings in the history of the United States of America, it sends a message. You're shaking your head, Emily.
You know,
why?
I don't agree with this.
Well, why don't you agree with it? Well, let's start with you.
We don't have any evidence. No.
You don't have any evidence.
You don't have any evidence
up for these people.
No.
And that's the whole
reason. The pedophilia ring. No. Hold on. To say that the Catholic Church has a monopoly on pedophilia. You just don't have evidence for that.
Excuse me, that's not the issue. I hope you're not going to do one of these things saying the percentage of public school teachers.
No, no, I'm not doing that.
The issue is there were a ton of priests who he knew about who were doing horrible things to young boys and girls about which he did absolutely nothing, continuing to put other boys and girls at risk.
And I've said this a thousand times, I'm going to say it again. We have a run 'em out of town mentality here in Boston. We ran this guy out of town.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't know what he knew when he knew it.
It's absolutely true.
And now he's not speaking to anybody about it, which is a tragedy because it's just too bad that he couldn't, you know, sit down with someone at this point and go through exactly what happened.
Well,
because
I don't think that's true. Tom Riley basically said on his when he failed to indict him, it seemed to me the former attorney general said, the only reason I am not indicting this man is because the statute of limitations has run
on his crimes. Jim,
it was pile on.
It was just pile on. Listen, the Globe saw the blood. There were some prizes. This was a real opportunity, and it was pile-on.
Gene Rivers, there are documents that show he totally ignored the pleas of mothers and others. He knew
all
some
I'm
of
saying
priests.
Is that there was not due process. This guy never got a hearing. No, wait a minute.
Excuse me. Why was there no due process?
There was
because
no
the
due process.
Cardinal
are you
chose
kidding?
Not to charge
Did you
any
read
of
the
these
papers?
People.
No. It was impossible. He was run out on arrest.
He was.
No. Listen. If he
also,
was, we were denied the opportunity.
I mean,
know how guilty
he was. We know
certain
things. We know that woman, Jackie Gavreau from Newton, came up to him more than once and said, do you know about Paul Shanley? Don't you know Paul Shanley? Somebody else approached him about John Gagan.
Yeah.
But there were boxes and boxes and files of people who complained about various priests, not just Paul Shanley and John Gagan. We don't know what he knew about that. We don't know whether he knew those files and those boxes existed because we ran him out of town
so, wait
so
a second.
Quickly.
Yeah, when you say we ran him out of town, then wouldn't the way to find out what he knew is for the cardinal who was in charge of the archdiocese to open up all records, hold hearings on everything, which he chose not to do.
No.
When you say, excuse me, when you say he was
we
run
forced
out of
him
town,
to
let
resign.
Let me finish this one. Yeah. When you said run out of town on a rail, he is the leader of one of the most luxurious basilicas in Rome.
No, that's not true anymore.
Yes, he is totally. He's the head of the...
He's got no juice, no power. No. This idea that's completely inflated in the States, that the guy is sitting on some power and it was a real...
I didn't say he had power. I say he's living in luxury.
It's some marginal...
Yeah,
completely. He's not living in luxury.
It's a ceremonial deal. And you know, and he just
lives
got
alone. He's all alone.
No.
I'm not saying weep for him, but he's got nobody around him, nothing.
No. Look, he got run out of town. He was denied due process. There was a media pile-on that just exploded, right? And so there was no opportunity
because
for him.
Because he led a cover-up.
He did not lead a cover-up. No. That's an exaggeration.
Okay, so let me ask you the last question. We'll move on before we get into a fist fight here over this. Is if the reports were true, which they apparently are not, according to the Vatican spokesperson, and the new pope had banished, probably is too strong a word, but had moved, ordered the move of Cardinal Law from this basilica to some monastery for the rest of his life, would that have been an unfair action on the part of the pope, Gene Rivers?
You know what? If he were given due process and there was actually a context where outside of the spin stuff of the media, they said, listen, you know, internally, we're going over this stuff. Bernie, we're shipping you to, you know, Siberia or whatever the political equivalent of Siberia would be for them. That'd be fair. I mean, listen, no one's defending pedophilia or pedophiles or the cover.
No, but you're saying it's spin.
Jim,
I think if you go to bishopaccountability.org, there's no
the
spin
pope
at all.
Wanted him to step down because if he had gone through
the prior pope, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
John Paul II. If he had gone through due process, he would have had to have named names. He would have had to have told us how this whole thing works.
That's right.
Who was the cardinal the other day who said it's not pedophilia? It's a mental health issue. The guy isn't totally wrong on this. There's another shoe here that we don't know.
It's not that simple, Jim.
There's a code here with a magic ring or something where they tell each other how to do this.
It's been passed down through the ages. There's actually a term for it within the Catholic circles. They talk about a lavender mafia. No, there's actually a code. No, there's a code.
They tell each other how to do it.
When you move in the Catholic circles, because I've had these conversations with
Cardinal
friends.
Cardinal Law would have had to have explained how this works.
Absolutely.
He would have had to have, I don't
blow
know
the whistle on the
it,
entire system.
So why didn't he blow? If he knew that the young boys
and
girls.
He would have gone all the way to the top of the Vatican.
No, absolutely.
And
no,
he
take the whole house down.
Because he took the
no,
vow.
No. In fact, he took a bullet for the team. The code, the ethic, the omerta, right? Because that's where the stuff actually comes from, right?
By the way, he took a bullet for the team, yet there were about a dozen teammates in that conclave who had done things comparable, maybe not in terms of volume,
sure.
From the Mahonies to some of the others.
Oh, no, there's some
who
worse.
Got to vote for a new
there
pope.
There was a guy in Mexico who was absolutely, I couldn't even believe it. No, so there's been worse stuff. So no one's denying that, but it's more complex. There is another
issue. How are you taking our side, Jim?
Right. Yeah. So.
No, I'm not taking your side. I'm just saying there are a lot of cardinal laws, but cardinal law, I think, literally got away with murder. But go ahead. There are other things I know that Gene wanted to talk about. Well, I have a stroke.
We want to talk about the new judge in the Whitey Bulger trial, Denise Casper. I don't know anything about her. She's young. She was appointed in 2010.
In fact, what I did over the weekend is I called all my lawyer friends that worked in the federal system to sort of get a beat. So who's Denise Casper, right? They said, look, she is a low profile person, Wesleyan, Harvard Law School, worked for Leona, black woman, has maintained a low profile and just worked the system. And she replaced a black guy who was the federal circuit judge. I'm blanking on the name. I should have this. Hold on. I might have it.
Well, go ahead. Continue.
Reginald Lindsay.
Oh.
she replaced Reginald Lindsay.
The Hill and Barlow guy, who actually, which was the place that a lot of these people
were. Yeah, and so and she did, was it Hutchin? No, what's the
name? McCutcheon.
Bigham McCutcheon.
Yeah, that's
right. She did Bigham McCutcheon. And the individual that I talked to say, listen, this is not a thing that most folk wanted to. You know, this is not a blessing. This is, you know, she'll get enormous visibility.
Wait, do you think this is serendipity that she was chosen?
No.
They said it was, you know, just grab bag, lottery, baloney.
Of course not.
So what's the agenda,
childish.
Emily? If it's not serendipity, what's the agenda?
I think, you know, the whole system here, J.W. Carney, who's the attorney for Whitey Bulger, was so adamant against Rick Stearns, who had once worked in the United States Prosecutor's Office at the time that all these deals were being cut with Whitey. Says, I'll tell you what, we'll get you a new judge, all right? There you go, Whitey. African-American woman.
A black woman. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. No, that was funny. No, and in fact, in the black community, there were lots of jokes, right, where they find out it was a sister, right? Yeah. It was a sister doing it, right? They said that's poetic justice.
But you don't know anything about her.
No. In fact, low profile, you know, and not well known, particularly in the black community. So when you sort of go around and you call up your half a dozen go-tos and say, what do you know about Denise Casper? Low profile, you know, from Long Island, Wesleyan, Harvard Law School.
I have to say, I'm in the white community. I'm embarrassed to say I never heard her name.
She was
announced
about her,
on Friday.
No. Low profile, doesn't move in the black legal
where
circles.
Where does she live? We don't even know.
Planning on picketing her house while you ask her.
I don't know if she takes public transportation, Jim. That's all.
Emily.
Like you.
No, actually, do you know, Gene Rivers, that Emily Rooney has never ridden on public transportation?
Oh, no, listen.
Now, what do you
know about that?
So what are you saying? If you didn't know it was Emily Rooney, and I said to you, Gene Rivers, this is a woman I know, is fairly prominent.
But she does take an Aspen.
Oh, you heard that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but wait a second. Don't avoid my question. Gene, there's this person I want you to meet, fairly prominent in town, pretty smart, too.
Yeah.
She has lived here a huge portion of her life, and she has never ridden public transportation. What conclusion would you draw about that person if you didn't know her name? You didn't know who she was. What would you say?
I think
go
she'd
ahead,
be...
Go ahead,
screw
it on straight.
No, I'll just say it straight. She says think they were... she must live in the black community. And didn't want to take the number 23.
Fair enough.
Bus. Because, listen, let me tell you something. I frankly, on that point... I wouldn't let my kids living in Dorchester take public transportation.
Your kids have never taken public transportation?
Oh, no.
That's
not what
true.
I was saying. No. I'm telling you, I'm living in Dorchester. There's a number 23 bus, and most shoot 'em up, stab 'em ups on that bus. No, our kids got chauffeured, and I would not have my daughter.
She said that to me, not Gene Rivers, by
exactly.
The way. Hey, Reverend Rivers, it was a pleasure as always. And maybe next week we'll continue the Cardinal Law thing, because I think Marjorie will even the score here.
I know. Marjorie's on your side. I know all about Marjorie's opinion.
No, she's on the side of right and justice.
Let's see.
I'll come back. We'll even it out.
I love you ideologically pure people. No, you paleo-high liberals. I love you.
You want to actually dwell on in this case the facts, Gene Rivers. Reverend Rivers, it's a pleasure to see you. See you next Monday at 1 o'clock.
All right, coming up. Everybody knows about Miranda. But does anybody here know about Gideon? Do you know Gideon, the Gideon case? I'm sure you do. Eugene Rivers does. All right, well, coming up, we're going to be talking about a Supreme Court ruling that made it possible for anyone, with money or not, to have legal counsel. Former Chief Justice Margaret Marshall joins us. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
What's the trick to making it big as an author? I'm not sure you're ready for this.
Rather than finding success through a bookstore, I found success through bathrooms and living rooms.
Authors going indie and making bank doing it, six figures and more. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the New Bedford Whaling Museum, presenting The Art of the Ship Model, a new exhibition exploring marine models as a true decorative art form, located in historic downtown New Bedford. More information at whalingmuseum.org. And Xfinity Home from Comcast, the new home security and home control solution where you can watch your kids get home safely without actually being there, or control your home from anywhere. You can learn more at xfinity.com/home.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney sitting in for Marjorie Egan. I'm Jim Browdy. 50 years ago, a Florida guy by the name of Clarence Earl Gideon stole some liquor and some money from a vending machine. When he's charged with burglary, he asks the judge for a lawyer. The judge says no. Well, Gideon went to jail but appealed the denial of counsel to the U.S. Supreme Court, which obviously led to the landmark decision, ruling that indigent defendants accused of serious crimes were entitled to free counsel, which, of course, allows TV cops to say you have a right to an attorney if you can't afford one, et cetera. The questions are, how are we doing in providing the poor with legal representation in criminal matters? And what about non-criminal proceedings where the stakes, at least in my opinion, are just as high? Here to discuss it with us is the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court. That would be Margaret Marshall. Pleasure to see you.
Welcome, Margaret Marshall.
Thank you.
And we should say that your husband, Anthony Lewis, former columnist for the New York Times, wrote the ultimate book, which you brought with you, Gideon's Trumpet.
It was published a year after 1964, and it's still in print. And a friend of mine told me this morning at breakfast that her son has just been assigned it at school. It's a great book. And, I mean, not because it's Tony. Tony wrote it long before I knew
him. You said it's inspired, you know, like thousands of people to go to law school, get law degrees.
That's why we have so many lawyers, and a very good thing, too.
Well, let's pick up where Jim sort of questioned, though. Has this worked? Has the Gideon decision worked in that everybody who deserves counsel actually gets a lawyer at trial?
The overall state for the United States is no, badly no. In some states, Massachusetts being one, it's not bad. In fact, it's pretty good in Massachusetts. And the reason is very simple. Two reasons. One is we have a statewide system. Statewide, so it's not county by county by county, which it is in New York and lots and other places. And yes, it depends on whether the local county provides it. Second, we've had a statewide educational system for public defenders. Third, we have a mix of public-private. So some are employed full-time as public defenders and others are members of the bar who get paid a reasonable rate, not a great rate, but a reasonable rate. And the legislature and Governor Patrick have been very good on funding, not as much as we need, but pretty good. And my view in Massachusetts, and I certainly sat on the Supreme Judicial Court, is particularly for serious felonies, which is where it really counts. I mean, Gideon, it counts all the way down. If you serve one day in prison, that's a lot. But when you get the murders and the rapes and the felony murders and the serious B&Es, you really need competent counsel. And in Massachusetts, we have fantastic counsel. Now, you know, friends who work in Florida, for example, he was in Florida. It's abysmal. It is abysmal.
Well, you know, it's not just, but people should say, even in places like Massachusetts, which take this seriously, when I was a kid, I was a young public defender before I did civil legal services work, which I want to talk to you about in a minute. Even if you have competent counsel in the abstract, if your lawyer has eight times as many cases as he or she can responsibly handle, which is the situation in many settings, then competent becomes incompetent, not because they don't have the brains or the skills, just because there's so many clients and families you can talk to, so many investigators you have. That's the biggest problem in a lot of the more, let's civilized parts of the country, is it not?
Absolutely. You put your finger on it. It's called, you know, meet and plead.
Yeah.
Meet and plead. You get given the file, and I've watched some of these lawyers, and they are terrific, but what happened in the Gideon case, what made the difference? Gideon was a kind of...
Was he guilty, by the way?
No, he wasn't.
See, Jim, he was not guilty.
Who said it?
You did.
He went to jail. He was in jail for a while.
Yeah, but he was
innocent. Not guilty.
He didn't get the time.
Oh, fine. Yeah, but he was found guilty, is what I'm saying.
You said he stole the stuff. He didn't steal.
My apologies.
So what made the difference? Critical difference is his lawyer, local lawyer, you know, went out and interviewed people, went to the pool hall. You know, he was accused of taking money out
beer
of the...
Beer,
but also, you know, the coins.
Yeah. From the vending machines.
From the vending machine. And he went out and interviewed. He actually looked. So the star witness, for example, had said that he was outside the pool hall and looked in. Fine, you know, that went down the first time. There was no cross-examination. The lawyer, the second time around, went, saw there were billboards and things, and so really put the guy who testified against Gideon was probably the guy who stole.
Yeah.
So, and he happened to see Gideon that night and said, well, that's a good one to blame. So to get back to the too many cases, if your lawyer is handed the Miller folder the day you have to come before a judge and takes a look at it and says, plead guilty, and you say, I didn't do it, that lawyer doesn't have time to go out and interview and talk to people, and that's what makes the difference. That and knowing the rules and cross-examination.
You know, Justice Marshall, one of the I was a represented poor people in mostly housing and prisoners' rights cases in the South Bronx when I was quite a bit younger. And what almost all of us said who had either those kinds of cases or custody cases, I mean, I'll give you an example. I would have, when we were overwhelmed and couldn't represent as many people as needed representation, we were government funded, but we were technically a private entity. I would have client after client say to me, I'd rather go to jail than lose my apartment. I'd rather go to jail than risk losing my child. So why is it that in 2013, you get a lawyer if you're poor, if you're facing jail time? You don't get a lawyer if you're poor. In some places you do, but you're not guaranteed a lawyer constitutionally if you're going to lose a kid, lose your house, lose your whatever. What's up with that?
Very good question. There's a movement afoot to say civil Gideon, and everybody says, well, you know, the courts can't do it. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts actually decided a Gideon-like case several years beforehand, and I've read the opinion. The SJC simply said, poor defendants, criminal defendants who face imprisonment, are entitled to a lawyer. They didn't say how it was going to get funded. So there is a move to do that. The Supreme Judicial Court has provided and has ordered the state to provide counsel in cases, for example, where your parent has been taken away. That's a, quote, civil case. What's critical now about keeping counsel in criminal cases is now you will lose your housing, public housing, if you're convicted. I mean, the rules are changing so much, and I think it is fair to say, and I say this very carefully, but the criminal justice system in the United States really is teetering on the brink of disaster. We have a higher incarceration rate. We've got more people serving longer sentences, and I think the reform moves are really to try to get the legislatures. It's much easier just to say, make the laws tougher, tougher, tougher. Take, you know, sexually dangerous persons. I mean, the laws concerning sexually dangerous persons, you're probably the most despised people in our society, are terrible.
Yeah, they're totally out of control.
You can't get housing. You can't get access to your kid. You can't get anything. And, of course, you need a lawyer for that. And so I think that movement is glowing.
When you say movement, let me just be clear. I'm sorry to interrupt you. And by the way, that's the voice of the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts, Margaret Marshall. A movement meaning for legislators to pass it. Why isn't there a case going before the Supreme Court saying, just like you determined 50 years ago, I think to the day, that a criminal defendant has such, what is it, a liberty interest at stake? There's a huge liberty interest with your kid, your house. Why is that case ever made it to the Supreme Court of the United States?
No, but there are cases that I think will bubble up. The problem is the people who on the civil Gideon side look at the criminal Gideon side and say, we've got this great case. I mean, the language is fantastic. You have a right to an attorney. And then they look at the reality on the ground and say what you really need is an executive legislative recognition mm-hmm. that this is a problem, and that's where the rubber hits the road. So to simply add caseloads for the tenants. There's a wonderful judge in the Boston Housing Court who's getting an award, terrific judge, you should talk to him. And what he's been doing is he looks at this and he has now got thousands of lawyers volunteering their time in housing cases. Jeffrey Winnick.
Oh, yeah.
And he just terrific. He's just done it. You know, okay. He's not waiting for the legislature.
That's a good question because that was going to raise an issue that I'm really interested about. We sent a producer into a court last week on a really interesting case that we're looking at, and it was a defendant who ostensibly doesn't have money. There was a pool of lawyers standing there, just, you know, a great big group of people. Bang, she gets assigned somebody. No one ever asked her if she had means. Nobody asked her, you know, it was just, do you need a lawyer? Yes. I mean, you know, if one of us in this room were in trouble, more than likely we would want to hire our own attorney because that person we would trust them and we'd be paying them and we would think they would do a good job for us. But my question is, is this out of control? Are we just willy-nilly assigning people public defenders when we don't even know if they've got the means?
No. You may find that there was an attorney assigned at the beginning, but there's now a pretty rigorous inquiry that follows before you can get public counsel. I mean, that's been one of the – and I give Governor Patrick credit and I give the Committee for Public Counsel Services credit. They really have been making sure that people are, in fact, eligible for a lawyer. By the way, Emily, if you need a lawyer, go to the Committee for Public Counsel Services. They're the best. They really are the best. I mean,
yeah, but the best example I can think of, and there's a – current events suggest there's a lot of empathy in this community for this guy, Sal DeMasi, in federal court. And I know the governor doesn't have it, nor does our legislature have decision-making over that. He was assigned counsel, was he not? And I think when the average person who can't afford a lawyer – well, the problem I always had as legal services lawyer is the middle class would say, if I was really poor, I can get a lawyer. If I'm really wealthy, I can buy a lawyer. I don't mean buy, but the middle class has virtually no access to lawyers. And a lot of people I know who were even sympathetic to DeMasi's cause – said, why is this guy why are my taxes paying for his representation?
I would imagine they went through an investigation, I mean, an inquiry, not an investigation, to see whether or not he qualified. And under the federal guidelines, he probably did. It's very, very, very expensive for most people. And I don't know what assets the former speaker had. But, you know, our elected representatives don't make a lot of money. And he'd been a legislator for a long, long time. And I don't know what his assets
were.
Yeah,
he was lining his pockets. I mean,
that's one of the reasons he's in jail. No. You know, you had that, Margaret Marshall, you had your husband's legendary book open.
Yep.
Were you intending to read a piece of that? Because if you are, go right ahead.
I just love the fact that, you know, when Gideon first shows up in court, that's what I love about this guy. I mean, this guy is a loser in some ways. You know, he's a petty thief. He gambles. He drinks.
So if he didn't steal the stuff from the vending machine, he stole something else.
Yeah,
right?
And he acknowledged. You know, he'd been convicted before. I mean, but I love it. And he's, you know, he's appealing in front of this trial judge down there in, you know, Florida. And, you know, the judge says, are you ready to go forward? He says, no. He says, well, Mr. Gideon, with no lawyer, why are you not ready to go forward? Well, says Gideon, the United States Supreme Court says I am entitled to be represented by counsel. I mean, that's right from the.
How did he know?
He was actually dead wrong.
Yeah.
It didn't
matter. Yeah, exactly.
They had actually decided the case 20 years before. But he took it, you know, there's a handwritten, I mean, he wrote the handwritten petition, and it went all the way up to the United States. That's what's so wonderful. And he's classic. I mean,
is he still alive?
No, he passed away. He passed away, but he, you know, at the end of the trial, or the second trial, when he was acquitted, because he actually didn't commit, he didn't, you know, steal this money. My husband, who was then working for the New York Times, said to him, you know, Mr. Gideon, do you think you accomplished anything? And he looked at Tony straight in the eye and he said, well, I did, didn't I?
That's great. Can I have one last question about this? Are you hopeful about the future on both fronts, about potential for expansion of a right to counsel to civil things, and on the criminal side, for legislators, considering that poor people really don't have a constituency quite often in amongst elected officials, with some exceptions. Are you hopeful that the money is going to be there in tough times? Are we going to have more suffering and more people inadequately represented than we have even now, Margaret Marshall?
Two things. I'm always hopeful because I really think we got pretty sane people. I just wish that people would stop doing more mandatory sentences for longer periods of time. It's the incarceration rate that is out of control.
Totally.
totally out of control.
Can I ask you one unrelated question? Everybody, I assume everybody listening here knows that amongst your great works, or at least amongst your high-profile works, since I'm assuming not everybody agrees, you wrote the decision, the 4-3 decision, the Goodrich case, which obviously legalized same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. Supreme Court, I think the oral argument is next Tuesday, mm-hmm. I think. Sometime 27th, is it? Okay. On Proposition 8, which obviously was the ballot initiative people know in California that said, and I'm paraphrasing, marriage is a union between a man and a woman. What's your sense of what happens at the Supreme Court of the United States on this, Margaret Marshall?
It's like Gideon. We got there first and they followed us. I just hope the same thing happens again.
I know you Will hope that. Like what do you think?
They have to, right?
I mean, it all depends on Justice Kennedy. They got superb lawyers for both cases. Vicki Jackson, professor at Harvard Law School, has been asked to brief the question about whether or not the court has jurisdiction. I can't imagine that the court is going to decide it doesn't have jurisdiction. You know, the court takes a look at what's happening around the country. I mean, it's the difference between 2013 and 2003 is night and day. It's amazing. Well,
you said what's happening around the country. I'm so glad. That was my last question. I don't know if you mean legislatively or if you mean politically. You know, the conventional wisdom when we're not what you used to be is that judges make decisions in part based on political environment. Many judges say, no, we don't. For the first time in the last few years, a majority of Americans support gay marriage. We talked earlier today, Senator Portman was the first Republican senator. Huge numbers of corporations are weighing in saying gay marriage is an important thing, plus you should repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. Does that matter to a court?
It certainly matters in this way. Let me give you an anecdote of this time. When Bowers against Hardwick, which was the United States Supreme Court case that upheld sodomy as a criminal offense that was overturned by Lawrence against Texas. So it's upholding sodomy as a criminal offense. Justice Powell is reputed to have turned to his law clerk and said, you know, I've never met a gay person. And the law clerk to whom he was talking was gay. So I think one of the things that has changed, and I have story after story, anecdote after anecdote, with people who... I mean, we all knew. I mean, I think it's just become easier for people to be public when they hold positions which they thought previously would put them at risk if they reveal their sexual orientation.
The debate really before the Supreme Court, though, isn't it once again the constitutional issue? Do you have a right to vote on somebody else's constitutional right? So they can get around this without necessarily endorsing gay marriage.
Certainly they can. I mean, for example, the New York case, the Canadian case. The two women were married under Canadian law. One way you could look at that, one way, is to say the United States is not required to recognize every foreign marriage, for example. They didn't take the Massachusetts case where the marriage had been in Massachusetts. So judges can work with the law in creative ways, and I hope they work in the way, you know, in a way that is has a good outcome here.
Before you walk out the door, 30 seconds more, you were rumored to be on the governor's short list of interim United States senators before Mo Cowan got it. Did you ever talk to him about it?
No, of course not.
He didn't call you in? Whoa.
You mean about Mo Cowan?
No, about you being the United States senator.
I'm delighted Mo Cowan is
That wasn't there. The question,
I know
Chief
that
Justice.
Wasn't the question.
Did you get a phone call? Did you go into the office? Did you have a chat?
I would have been honored to serve, but
yeah,
no,
we
I
all
didn't.
Would have.
You didn't speak to the governor.
I didn't speak to
people.
The governor.
All right, we've been
Margaret
talking.
Margaret Marshall, it's great to see you. Thank you.
Chief Justice Margaret Marshall.
Thank you.
And so coming up, and this is something that I think the Chief Justice probably isn't into, but I could be wrong.
Maybe she is.
Serial
you don't
killers
know.
Taking over the small screen. Do you watch any of these things?
Oh, I hate them.
Okay, I figured. Hannibal Lecter, Legacy of Jack the Ripper. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Ryan McKnight has been at the top of the R&B game since the 1990s.
I think it's been 21 years since my first album came out, and I think I've made too many.
But that's not stopping him. His latest is More Than Words, and he'll tell us all about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Nobody really wants to be lonely. I'ma stay this way.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And Fallon Community Health Plan, doing more to encourage active, healthier living, like innovative fitness reimbursement benefits for kids' school and town sports. More information available at fchp.org.
Emily Rooney here in the studio with Jim Browdy. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Marjorie Egan. He'll be back on Thursday, I think. She's in Rome with her kid. That's kind of sweet.
And with the Pope.
Yeah, well, that's right.
She's hanging out with the Pope.
See the elevation. All right, joining us in the studio are Boston Globe's Matt Gilbert and Sarah Rodman. Matt Gilbert is a critic covering TV. Sarah Rodman also covers TV in addition to pop music. Welcome back to all of you. We're going to be talking today about serial killer shows, everything from Dexter to the kind of the process shows, as my daughter calls them, things like Criminal Minds and CSI and all those. My daughter's a big fan of The Walking Dead, and she got me to sit down and at least start watching it with her once. And I actually like things like Criminal Minds and CSI because, as she says, I'm a process person, so I can kind of follow that. But I could not do The Walking Dead. Could not do it.
It is a little. It can be kind of gross.
Yeah, it's
kind
gross
of.
And,
oh my god.
Well, if you don't enjoy a zombie,
and the writing is not great.
Oh, she says it's good.
It's very slow.
She, yeah,
too.
She thinks it is.
Wait, can
slow?
We go back to the beginning? What is the allure? I cannot tell a lie. I've not seen Dexter. However, what is the allure of serial killer shows? For those who are listening and don't know, there's a huge list of shows where either the show is about a serial killer or other series where a serial killer is central to the plot. Matt, what's the deal? What's happening? Is this all a reflection of Hannibal Lecter, one of the greatest movies of all time, Silence of the Lambs? Is that what it's about?
Which, by the way, I believe that was sort of the landmark in serial killer dramas. I mean, so many of the shows that we see now about serial killers sprung from that movie. But there's a new show premiering in the first week of April called Hannibal, which is actually literally about Hannibal Lecter.
Can't wait.
I mean,
Evergreen, Chianti.
Yeah. Have you guys seen it yet? Have you seen a preview?
We have not.
We got the DVD,
we got them,
but
we
haven't watched
them
yet.
Well, to get you in the
mood,
actually, before you continue, do you want to hear a few seconds? Here's a little bit of the clip from the trailer for this new NBC series, Hannibal. Here it is.
Mr. Graham, Special Agent Jack Crawford.
Can I borrow your imagination?
You FBI?
I'm a special investigator.
He catches insane men because he can think like them.
He can enter the mind of a killer in a way that no one ever has.
Sarah Rodman, I know Anthony Hopkins. I've watched Anthony Hopkins. I mean, come on. Right. You can't recreate
Mads
brilliance.
Is Anthony Hopkins.
So, but what is the... I mean, so Matt was tracing the sort of chronology. Right. Why is it that these are so huge right now?
I mean, when you think about through history, though, we've always been interested in famous killers, right?
Ted Bundy.
Whether it was outlaws, the Dalton Gang. I mean, spree killers, serial killers. It's something that we've been interested in before there was television or film. I mean, I think part of it, the appeal on television, as you say on the procedural shows, is that it puts it in a framework that sues us. Like the BAU and the FBI and the CBI and all these people are going to catch them. And it makes us feel good at the end of the hour that they've taken care of that in a neat little box.
But Dexter, which I haven't seen, is a serial killer killing serial killers.
I mean,
how
great
is
that?
We feel good about that.
No,
is that it?
It's because he's a good serial killer.
No, it's creepy beyond belief.
You've seen it?
Once.
Okay.
I think Dexter is a different kind of show from the procedurals. It doesn't make us feel good, but it puts us it's superior, or it was at least for the first 3 years, because it puts the viewer in this weird moral position because we're rooting for this guy. We want him to kill the killers, you know?
And because the killers whom he kills, I assume, are really hateful. Is that the notion?
Exactly.
And he is like a white knight kind of deal.
He's a vigilante, essentially.
That's what I was
trying to say. Yeah, so
who we would believe we would be if we could be.
Yeah, it's about capital punishment, I think. You know, so to me, that show stands apart from, say, Criminal Minds, which is what Sarah was saying.
What's the name of the famous Charles Bronson film from about 400 years ago?
Yeah, The Vigil.
When he goes out and kills everybody.
Vigil.
No, you're thinking Walking Tall.
No, not that. But what's it called?
Death Wish.
That's what it was. Thank you. One of our colleagues came up with that.
That was a great movie.
I mean, that's sort of a prequel to this sickness,
is it
not?
But I mean, it sort of taps into that bloodthirstiness that we all have that we don't like to talk about, right? That like, you know, we get enraged, right? But we don't act on it because we are not those people. And especially in Dexter's case, when he's, you know, taking that rage out on someone who is a bad person, that, you know, does something for us. It gives us, you know,
the actor and singer Mandy Patinkin quit Criminal Minds, saying that he just couldn't bear, you know, the ghoulish every week, a horrible, you know, but yeah. Maybe it was you who wrote about it, said he's made a mistake because these are the shows that are attracting.
Well, he's on Homeland
viewers.
Now, which is one of the greatest shows ever.
And he also quit shows. Right. I mean, Mandy Patinkin is sort of famous for quitting shows,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he is. He's sensitive.
But, you know, this
but
whole,
a great actor.
Well,
yeah.
When I was listening to both you, Matt Gilbert and Sarah Rodman from The Globe, at first I'm saying this is ridiculous. I mean, but then I say to myself, I was a 24 fan, and I can't tell you how many liberal anti-torture people would root on Jack Bauer.
Exactly.
When he was torturing people, it's sort of... So
how many people wanted Tony Soprano to kill people on The Sopranos?
That's another great point.
I mean, our buttons are pushed by this in a way that's satisfying to root on the bad guy. Some people root for Darth Vader. I'm one of them.
That's true. Here's a little Dexter, by the way, if you've missed it, which I have, Emily, seen one of them. Here's a little bit, a clip from the Showtime series, Dexter.
So, why are you here?
It's a crime scene.
Yeah, but you do blood spatter.
So?
There's no blood here.
What was that?
Yeah. There's no blood in or on or near the body at all. It's the weirdest thing you ever saw. Hey, Angel, let's show him.
No blood. No sticky, hot, messy, awful blood. No blood at all. Why hadn't I thought of that? No blood. What a beautiful idea.
Sounds like a Saturday Night Live
skit. These guys are always smarter than all the other, you know, investigators and the homicide people. They're always the smartest kid in class. You know, that's part of it too, right?
Right. Sociopaths. They're smarter than you and me.
Why do all people like you write that Dexter was great and now it's not so great? What happened?
I think they just went overboard with the killing in a way. I mean, at a certain point, it has no power anymore. You know, the first few seasons, the kills were so grotesque, and you felt something while you were watching them. Now it's like, oh, Dexter had a kill.
And that's why it's, I think, been ramped up on, I mean, something like The Following. I mean, the shows that are doing well now, the reason it's so much is because cable television has pushed the envelope so far that, you know, network has gone farther than it ever has in the past. I mean, you know, ice picks to the eyes.
Right.
And, you
love
know,
that, yeah.
And it's, writing on people's bodies and stuff.
And it's not just cable TV. It's also video games. You know,
and movies too.
They're competing with a lot of very extreme things.
Can we talk about something that's a little more modest?
Jim's obsessed.
And so, this is one of my obsessions. Starting a couple of years ago, I think it was like 3 years ago, after Lost had been on for, I don't know, it reached its 100th episode. So I don't know how many years that was. Over a weekend, I saw maybe 3 or 4 days over some Christmas vacation, I saw every single one of the 100 episodes of Lost. And since that, I saw three years of Breaking Bad or whatever it was over maybe a 2 week period. It's called binge viewing.
Yes.
And now Netflix has something out that they're releasing the whole series of Sarah
House
Rodman.
Of Cards. And
what's it called? House of Cards?
House of Cards. Yeah. And so, it's all out right now.
So I love this. This is happening, right? I mean, a lot of people are doing this.
Oh, no. This has been a trend for a while. I mean, especially in the sort of golden age of television that we're talking about, when people can't make those appointments, when the DVD sets come out or they're on demand and you're doing your laundry or whatever it is for 6 hours on a Saturday, how great is it just to lie there and catch up with Breaking Bad or catch up with, you know, people now watching The Wire. I mean, this is something that
went
off
the
years.
What do the networks get out of it?
The
gym sitting down wasting 100 hours. What do they get out of it?
Well, DVD sales is one thing that the production companies get out of it. And, you know, sort of that brand loyalty that then whatever
you're not
the next
watching
thing
on
that
DVD,
watch.
You watched it for free, right?
Well, right, but then you catch up with it when it comes back on, right?
I'll give you an example. What's the name of the spinoff? I'm sorry, Boardwalk Empire. I bought because I couldn't get them online somewhere for some reason. I went out and bought the first 2 years and watched them and Weekend too. Are you cynic about this, Matt Gilbert? You look.
I'm not a huge fan of binge watching.
What? I mean, it is so great. I mean, not only are there no commercials, you don't have to wait for the next thing. You leave a series, and I know the excitement you waited. Who wants to wait a week when you're totally into something?
I do.
3 seconds later.
I'll
tell you why.
I want instant gratification society.
Exactly. I mean, I like the idea of letting a week pass, especially, you know, if it's a good show and you can revisit the episode and think more about it. And then by the time the next episode comes, you're ready to move forward with the storyline.
I don't want to think for 1 minute. What are you talking about? Just press the button and get
you get to talk to people. I mean, you know, if one episode airs every week, then you can all sort of do the water cooler thing. And then the next episode.
Yes.
I like the communal aspect.
So had you never seen Lost before?
Never. I'd not only never seen it, I had barely heard of it.
So I watched the first episode and I can remember making this And I liked it. Mm. Making this very conscious decision, I am never watching this show again. Because I was afraid I was going to get kind of swept in. And I knew it would go off into 1,000 different directions. And half the time I wouldn't be able to follow it. And, you know, it was supernatural. And then it wasn't supernatural. And it was going to end up being somebody's dream or something like that. I don't even know how it ended. But that's the decision I made.
Don't go there.
Really?
I should say, in the spirit of full disclosure, that's why I lost my other job in radio. I just never showed up. This one. By the way, if anybody out there is as much into binge viewing as I am, because there are at least two cynics in the studio, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
There's pros and cons to it. I mean, it depends on, and what you were saying about what the, you know, networks get out of it. If you started watching Breaking Bad and you caught up on all four seasons last weekend, mm-hmm. when it comes back next year, you're likely to start watching it again and subscribe to HBO or whatever it is you need to do.
So what's the theory behind this Netflix thing, though? The Netflix thing is different from what I understand.
It's called House of Cards.
House of Cards, sorry. And they're releasing the whole series.
Yes, it's already all out. They released it all on the same
day. And so what's the thinking behind
that? But they're doing that with a whole bunch of series.
Yeah, they're doing that with Arrested Development in May.
Since when is Netflix doing their own stuff? Is this a first?
Well, they've been doing it for a while, but now they're really starting to amp it up. And House of Cards was hugely successful, so I think we'll see more of this kind of episode dump.
Wasn't it them that was trying to get all the networks on board to do this and for like a month and give everybody free access? So
Was it Netflix or Hulu?
I thought it was
all I would like to say while she's asking the question, I ask who's a binge viewer, and the lines fill up in 10 seconds.
Because they're all angry. I'll tell you. Okay, every conversation I've had about House of Cards since it started was, hey, have you seen it? Yeah, what episode are you on? Oh, I'm on episode 4, so don't say anything.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, Michael's a binge viewer. Go ahead.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, good day. How are you?
Great.
Jim, we have that in common, and it's actually sad. But
why are you into it, Michael? What's explain it to these people.
Well, I've got an interesting perspective on Netflix in that I got tired of spending $80 a month for cable and then basically getting squeezed into one I had to watch it. And then I got to the Netflix and found all these old series that I hadn't seen in a long time, Boston Legal.
$7.99 a month, by the way. It's a good deal.
Mm. Yeah, and then unfortunately, the problem is when you find a show you've never seen, like Warehouse 13.
Such a good show.
But you start on that, and it's like, okay, I've got 6 seasons here, and it's Saturday morning, and then before you know it, it's Sunday afternoon, you haven't left yet, all the popcorn's gone in the house, and your fridge is empty.
But it's Warehouse 13.
And then the sad thing is when you've gotten through all of the seasons that are on Netflix, and then you find out that it's still on TV, and there's a new season come out. How am I going to wait a year? Now I'm going to have to cable.
I'm so with you. Hey, Michael, thanks for the call. By the way, speaking of binge viewing, there's binge gardener viewing.
This is amazing. Yeah, the FBI say they have identified the thieves who stole the paintings from the Gardner Museum in 1990, but haven't been able to locate the paintings. Oh. But they're having a 2 o'clock press on, so we'll stay tuned for the details on that. That's pretty exciting.
It is exciting, but no more exciting than binge viewing, as far as I'm concerned. Let's go to Travis in Elliott, Maine. You're on with Emily Rooney, Jim Browdy, Sarah Robin, and Matt Gilbert. Hey, Travis.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
Thanks for calling my call.
Thanks. Go.
I just wanted to call and say that I am a huge fan of binge viewing. I actually do not own a television, so the only television shows that I do watch are after they've come out online, and I can either watch them on Netflix or find them other ways.
You sound like a very healthy man, Travis, I should
say.
You're
somebody who hates it, though.
Travis, thanks for the call.
Don't say my last name online, right?
Travis, thanks. Let's go.
Christopher from Rhode Island. He hates binge viewing. Go ahead, Christopher.
Hi, how you doing? I love binge viewing. I think it presents a conundrum, however, as somebody who is a film writer and sometimes TV writer, when you're trying to create this stuff, you try to look at this from a novelistic approach. And binge viewing certainly lends a novelistic quality to the experience of watching Breaking Bad or certainly a House of Cards. But, it eliminates water cooler conversation. I don't know if you guys covered that earlier. I just tuned in a minute ago.
Yeah, actually, Matt said that,
Yeah, and that presents a problem for networks in particular because, getting that buzz. Netflix, I think, can get away with it. HBO can get away with people binge viewing. But, it's really, really tough for some of the networks, I think, to try that sort of thing. Again, after the fact, sure, Netflix is going to stream. I think somebody mentioned Boston Public. David E. Kelly show, good show. There's other stuff, but it presents a production conundrum, I think.
As a writer?
Yes, let me ask you a question.
Doesn't binge viewing also make you nervous about continuity? Because I find that people, you can't sort of, the canon has to be the canon when people are watching 15 in a row. You can't drop a storyline or...
Yeah, really, you need to be very careful about introducing ancillary characters because a lot of people will expect, oh, where's everything going to go? And if you drop them, and it, again, as somebody who's been in this industry for a little while now, I spot that. Stuff a mile away. I have to watch my language. That stuff a mile away. But it's a conundrum. I think it's though something that everybody in the industry certainly has got to get used to. And it opens up the streaming. There's so much stuff going on with not just Netflix, Hulu Plus, Roku, what you can get through Roku, the different streaming services, all the YouTube channels now. There's a lot happening, and binge viewing for some of those things, I think, is perfect.
Christopher, you were eloquent. You were perfect. Well, Matt, can I make a suggestion? I mean, now you know your business. We're going to have you back in 2 weeks.
All right.
First week, you watch 4 years of Greater Boston with Emma Rennie. Next week, you watch 3 or 4 years of Broadside the News with Jim Rowdy. And see, have an open mind and see if it, you agree with me, right? That'd be unbelievable, Sarah,
oh,
wouldn't it?
Oh, my God. Especially the episodes that I was on.
You laugh, you cry, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. It's
I think I'll be like the Walking Dead if I return.
By the way, Emily can't participate in this discussion because she's so excited
about
the
Gardener.
I'm so
excited about the Gardener. I know. I can't stand
it. Really, about the
they know
Scorsese
who did it, but they're not saying,
out.
And they don't know where the paintings are, but they've got the names, which is pretty cool.
So
could
maybe
be
we'll a, tell you
could
tomorrow.
Be that former guard, too, Richard Abbath. Which
Abbath.
The,
Steve Kirchner wrote about
yeah,
the other
yeah,
day. Hey, Matt Gilbert and Sarah Rodman, as always, thank you hugely. We really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank
We're
you.
Listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Emily and I, Marjorie's still on vacation. We may talk about the Gardener.
We're
I assume
going to
we
have to
will.
Redo our teases because we didn't have that right.
Emily and I are also going to debate the decision to send two high school football players in Ohio to jail for the rape of another teen. John King from CNN will be here, Charlie Baker, and whether his former boss, Bill Weld, may run against them for governor. But all Emily wants to do tomorrow is the Gardener.
I
it's
do.
Pretty clear from
so
looking. I mean, she's
obsessed.
Not even paying attention.
I'm not obsessed
anymore.
With binge viewing. I'm obsessed with the Gardener.
Fair enough. She is Emily Rooney. I am Jim Brody. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow noon.